Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Hi, this is Brian Elias, president of 1-800-HANSONS. Need new windows, siding, roofing, doors, or gutter protection, but not quite ready to buy? Well, click on the banner above and enter my exciting home makeover sweepstakes. You could win the home improvement of your dreams. Come on, get it done.
Water, and I'm talking to the trees. See the angels and the faces and the beggars.
City Red on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Can I help you find a specific paint color today? Oh, Mr. and Mrs. Hall.
Hello again, Randy.
I take it.
Mary got her hair done again.
Ah.
You know the drill. Every time she goes and gets her hair colored at Fantastic Sam's, she gets all excited.
And wants to change the color of everything.
They have so many great options. It's just all so inspiring.
We're up to 87 different colored coats in the living room, I think.
I just can't help myself.
Walls are starting to crowd in a little on the furniture, Randy.
Wow, this is serious.
Hey, it's nothing compared to last month when she added highlights.
The entire living room was painted cocoa brown with yellow stripes. It was a masterpiece. You know, I think tomorrow I'll go in for a touch-up.
Don't we have some plans tomorrow?
Here, take two cans.
Color, highlights, waves, a touch-up on your current style, or a whole new look. How far do you want to go? Fantastic Sam's.
The expert stylists at Fantastic Sam's are always being trained on the latest styles and techniques. From the hottest cuts to color trends, highlights, lowlights, texturizing, and waves. Stop in and ask for your free consultation on which look will complement you the most. At Fantastic Sam's, the possibilities are endless.
It's time to live the mortgage expert. 800-333-ROCK.
Hey, I'm David Hall from Rock Financial, coming at you with some very important information about prepayment penalties. At Rock Financial, we simply don't have them, and we don't believe in them. Prepayment penalties are an unnecessary charge, and other lenders may penalize you for paying more towards your principal or paying off your mortgage sooner than you expected. Well, you got to have a lender you can trust to be there and working for you. Rock Financial is Michigan's largest mortgage company, and homeowners have been trusting us for over 20 years. Our exclusive programs, well, they give you the competitive edge you've been looking for. Find out why 9 out of 10 of our clients refer us to friends and family. Call the mortgage experts today.
It's time to live. Yeah. 800-333-ROCK. The mortgage experts. 800-333-ROCK.
A Quicken Loans Company. Equal housing lender.
So-called hot spots. Where have all the fun people gone? They're at Screwy Louie's in South Lyon. Power hour every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday with dollar drinks from 11 to midnight and talk about beautiful women. The best sports on 29 TVs and no Dancing with the Stars. Plus karaoke Thursdays and a live DJ Fridays and Saturdays. Screwy Louie's South Lyon on Lake Street at Lafayette. Log on to WRIF.com for more info on the Riffs Friday Night Live at Screwy Louie's South Lyon.
Are you tired of having more credit card bills than you can pay? Now you can eliminate up to 60 60% of your credit card debt. Call Debt Relief of America for a free, no-obligation debt consultation. They'll give you all the details. You could save thousands in interest, late fees, and penalties. They do the work for you, and you don't have to talk to your creditors anymore. End the stress that comes with debt. Call now, 800-732-1749. 800-732-1749. That's 800-732-1749.
Hi, this is now Hall of Famer Wade Boggs, and I'd like to talk to you about another exclusive group that I belong to that has changed my life. I'm talking about thousands of guys who, just like me, have decided to take control of their hair loss and regrow their hair permanently with the pros at Medical Hair Restoration.
Take control of your hair loss and regrow your hair permanently. Call 800-380-4147 for a free DVD package rushed to you that'll show you just how easy this process is. Call now, 800-380-4147. Put hair back in your life.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Hey, thank you very much, and we get all this music out of here. Thank you for joining us. Another session, Night Call, 313-298-WRIF, email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And I usually have a little script here talking about our sponsor, but I forgot it, so I'm going to have to see if I can do it from memory. This hour of Night Call brought to you by Waking Up, the sweatshop-free clothing store, Universal Mall in Warren, 13 Mile in Quinder, or you can go to wakingupstore.com. If you go to wakingupstore.com, you can see the newsletter, I guess is what it is, and some photographs of me looking a little disheveled, but I think I'm beginning to look a little more and more disheveled. It's getting to be okay again. You can kind of look, you don't have to shave all the time. You can wear, raggedy-ass clothes and stuff like that, so that's pretty cool. But anyway, if there was a Green Expo out there sponsored by the Waking Up Store at the Universal Mall, and so if you go there, you can see the report of it and what have you. The Waking Up Store is going to be closed Thursday, October 5th for The World Can't Wait. Now, this is an international effort, and it's going to take place in over 150 cities across the country and across the world. You can go to worldcantwait.net. worldcantwait.net. Essentially, it's a call for no work, no school, drive out the Bush regime. That's where your head's at. Mine is. So I'm not going to work on Thursday. Of course, I often don't work on Thursday. And it's a little tough. Essentially, it's a call for a general strike. And that has been very powerful over the last century and a half for either whole populations like in Ukraine and Bolivia in recent times, or it also just the working class itself sometimes says, we're going to have a general strike until you do this or what have you. 60 Minutes was on tonight with Bob Woodward. And Bob Woodward says, essentially, this brand new book called State of Denial, that the White House ignored an urgent warning in September 2003 from a top Iraq advisor who said thousands of additional troops are desperately needed to quell the insurgency, and was absolutely ignored by Bush Incorporated, Bush and Company. And Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld, who apparently everybody wanted to resign, and he just won't do it. Did any of you see the 60 Minutes thing? I was working. Joining me is Shannon Caldwell. Do you have a mic? Yeah. Well, Shannon's here with me. Anyway, he's a colleague here at Greater Media. And let's see. Secretary of Rumsfeld is described as disengaged from the nuts and bolts of occupying and reconstructing Iraq, a task that was initially supposed to be under the direction of the Pentagon, and so hostile towards Condoleezza Rice that Bush had to tell him to return her phone calls. Hey, return her calls. Okay. I know what you're going to say, Shannon. I'd have to give you turn on your mic. You know what? There is no mic. There is not a mic on this board for you. It's me.
You changed
me.
Your settings, Peter.
Well, I know, this is all about me.
Of course.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to say. We could get Shannon on the air. But look, you got to have mic one, mic two, right? Oh, wait a minute. Here
yes,
we go.
Exactly.
Yeah, try one or two.
1-1-1.
Yeah.
One Peter Werby Show.
Yes. Hi, Shannon.
Hello, Peter.
Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
Did you see 60 Minutes?
I did not.
I didn't either. So, all right.
Turn that girl's mic off.
Yeah, all right. Thanks, been nice having you here. Appreciate it. Well, what happened today? Tigers lost and lost the Central Division Championship in the process. Minnesota got that. The Lions lost. Anything else happen of any import? Oh, yeah, that's right. Bush just assumed one-man rule of the country and of the world, as a matter of fact. He's king of the world. Now, I hope you know what I'm talking about, because all of a sudden this was kind of debated. Essentially, it's called the torture bill, or the bill that removes habeas corpus, or, well, here, Marjorie Cohn, writing at counterpunch.org, says, and it's called the Military Commissions Act of 2006. It governs the treatment of detainees. And she says the culmination of relentless fear-mongering by the Bush administration, so the September 11th attacks. She says because the bill was adopted with lightning speed, and a lot of the Democrats just crumpled, like Michigan's Senator Debbie Stabenow voted for this, which I think she's probably thought that was the political thing to do, but I think she's probably just lost a lot of votes, like mine. So I'm voting for the Green candidate. Screw Debbie Stabenow. Even if that means old Bouchard. I can't think of his first name. Sheriff of Oakland County. But Bush has portrayed the bill as a tough way to deal with aliens to protect us against terrorism. Anyone who donates, here's some of the things. Anyone who donates money to a charity that turns up on a Bush list of terrorist organization or who speaks out against the government's policies could be declared an unlawful enemy combatant and imprisoned indefinitely. That includes American citizens. Well, let's talk about the Tigers. All right, the hell with all this stuff. We love President Bush and the Tigers. What do you think about their, you know, hey, come on, screw him. And that's the nicest way I can put it and still keep my job. Let's see. The bill also strips away habeas corpus rights from detained aliens who have been declared enemy combatants. Now, what that is, essentially, this is something I think that's won about 700 years ago or so in the Magna Carta. You remember that from high school or college where they said that the king couldn't just imprison people forever, that he had to be brought before the prisoner, had to be brought before a court, and then the government could say, we're holding you because you are charged with, and here are the charges against you spelled out very specifically. That's all gone under this bill. Let's see. Congress has the constitutional power to suspend habeas corpus only in times of rebellion or invasion. That was done by Lincoln during the Civil War. The habeas stripping provision in the new bill is unconstitutional, she says, and she's a constitutional lawyer. The Supreme Court will likely say so when the issue comes before it. So what's going on here? It's none of this is necessary. So why is Bush doing this? Well, it is this his vision of rule. One-man rule, the balance of, what do they call it? The balance of power. What's that little phrase that they use? Checks and balances. Right.
That phrase.
That little phrase. So that you had three co-equal branches and they each had a specific role. Now, the guys that put the Constitution together, there are a lot of flaws in that. Like, what's one big one? Slavery. But still, they're pretty foresightful, if you will, in understanding a new paradigm, a new model of government that had never been tried really on Earth. I mean, there was step towards it, like in the English Revolution of 1688 and all that, but nothing that constitutionally guaranteed citizens particular rights. And they looked around. They looked around at Europe, and they saw what was wrong. And they put all of this in here, things like speedy trial, and you couldn't be tortured, and stuff like that. This bill, by the way, well, maybe actually I can kind of just read some more of this stuff. This is from prisonplanet.com. Some of this is on my website as well, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E. Hey, and jump in the conversation anytime you like, by the way, 3298-WRIF. Buried among the untold affronts to the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, and the very spirit of America, the torture bill, and that's a good name for it, contains a definition of, quote, wrongfully aiding the enemy, close quote, which labels all American citizens who breach, quote, allegiance to President Bush and the actions of the government as terrorists, subject to possible arrest, torture, and conviction in front of a military tribunal. Now, why do they need these military tribunals? If these men that they've been holding incommunicado in these secret prisons somewhere in the world for 4 years were guilty of crimes, why weren't they brought before some judicial body long time ago. Well, they had to torture the stuff out of him. Okay, how long does that take? After a while, you just got all the information out of him. Think it could have anything to do with the elections coming up, that maybe they popped these guys out to say, now we have the perpetrators of 9/11. Of course, if that happened in the United States, and you were held for 4 weeks, let alone 4 years, and you confessed and they had all this evidence, any court in the land would throw that out, even if you had killed half of a city. I mean, well, let's get back to reality. Say burglary or murder. That the courts supervise these constitutional guarantees and rights, not because they're sympathetic to criminals or perpetrators of crime, but rather they know if you allow this stuff to stand in this manner, they're going to be carried out in the manner that dictators and authoritarian rulers always have. So here's some more of this stuff. The detainee treatment bill. And rather than reining in the formidable presidential powers that Bush and Cheney have asserted since September 11th, the law gives some of those powers a solid statutory foundation. In effect, it allows the president to identify enemies. This is one-man rule. This is a dictatorship. This is Ceausescu of Romania, I mean, in terms of kind of his popularity and the mental abilities and respect for law. So the law is out the window. Constitutional guarantees are out the window. Bush can now identify people as enemies, or Donald Rumsfeld, who everybody in the Bush administration, other than Bush and Cheney, want to get rid of as a total incompetent anyway, right? Let's see. It also, they can be imprisoned for indefinite amount of times and interrogate them with the man which the president proscribes. Is it proscribed? No, prescribes. Proscribes, I think you can't do. But hey, it's good news. In the bill, it specifically says you can't do things like rape the prisoners or disfigure them. So that's good. I mean, the American really need to be prohibited from doing those things? And there's a whole host of stuff as well. You know, there's something in here. Let me see if I can find this real quickly. 14,000 people are currently in U.S. war prisons across the world, the majority of them in Iraq, but all of them beyond the law. In 2003, it was judged that 70 to 90% of the Iraq detentions were mistakes, according to U.S. Army officers. So this is who gets ground up in this. And, oh, don't tell me that I can't find this. This is amazing. All right. Because I want to quote from this. This is the most amazing thing I can imagine. Here's this, the statute. Any person subject to this chapter who, in breach of an allegiance or duty to the United States, knowingly and intentionally aids an enemy of the United States or one of the co-belligerents of the enemy, shall be punished as a military commission under this chapter may direct. Now, how many times have you heard these right-wingers say that liberals, let alone harsher critics of the government, are aiding the enemy? Remember, how many times has Cheney said that? So they would say, I'm aiding the enemy. You're aiding the enemy. And they're going to throw us away and or lock us up and throw away the key. If I can find this, you're not going to believe this. And I don't want to just make it up as I go along. No, this is, well, I'm going to look for it during the break. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Again, anybody see the Bob Woodward talk on 60 Minutes? Let's see. All right. We don't have a lot on here in terms of where to go next to. Okay. I see what you have to say up there. Here's old dog. Old dog. One old dog to another. What's happening, old dog?
I love it. How you doing today, Peter?
Doing great. Thanks. Thanks for calling.
Good. I just got into the Detroit area and heard your show, and it's like I couldn't believe it, man. Bush ought to be in a box with the rest of those detainees and see what it's like.
Well,
I got a friend that's a young Republican. She's terrible for lying about his indiscretions with Monica Lewinsky. I said, well, at least he didn't lie about...
Nobody died.
He didn't lie about the
Are they still talking about that? I mean, you got all these Republicans sending this, you know, sending these emails to like teenage House pages, and they're resigning faster than, you know, you can shake a stick, eh?
Oh yeah, you know, Bush lied about all the intelligence and took us to war and got a bunch of people killed. And my buddy Zoe says, you got to get all the facts. And I said, no, you got to get all the facts and think for yourself. I said, you're letting the Republican Party think for you and Bush think for you. And I says, you're stupid.
Well,
that's like gas prices. Republicans keep control of the House, they'll be paying $5 by Christmas.
Yeah, because, you know, the guys that knock down the prices are going to want their money back, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, they're all Bush and Cheney's buddies.
You got it. All right, old dog. Thanks for calling into the show. I appreciate it. Let's see. Here is Dave. Dave's in Redford. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. What you're saying about Bush trying to turn it into a one-man show, and with the checks and balances that are in place from our Constitution that was written by, you know, the former founding fathers, it's stupid. How can he turn this country into a, it's basically a democracy, but he's trying to turn it into a communist.
Well,
being a dictatorship.
Well, you know, too, the main thing is he says that all of these people that are being held at Guantanamo Bay, they have lawsuits saying, hey, look, we've been here for 3 or 4 years. Almost everybody admits that at least 70% of the people being held without trial, without charges, are innocent of anything. They got scooped up. They had bounty hunters over there. The United States paid millions of dollars to get these guys into these secret jails. And they can't get out. And what they've been doing is they've been suing in federal courts. And now this new bill says all of your lawsuits are null and void. And
yeah,
all
maybe nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but see, that's the problem. Too many people are spending too much money on the wrong things. I mean, look at all these oil companies are making billions and billions of dollars of profit. And everybody else is looking around going, how are we going to pay our bills, you know? And then Bush, he controls a fair amount of an oil industry, so he has a lot of say in that. And he tries to push it behind everybody's back like, you know, nobody's saying anything. And, you know, he's going behind everybody's back saying, you know, and he comes out and lies to people. It's
well, here, you know, this new book by Bob Woodward called State of Denial. Yeah, and I guess he said this on 60 Minutes tonight. This is just a transcript of it. He described a conversation between Saudi Prince Bandar bin Sultan and Bush in which the former Saudi ambassador said he could ease oil prices ahead of the elections. According to Woodward, they could. He said they could go down very quickly. That's the Saudi pledge. Certainly over the summer, or as we get closer to the election, it increased production several million barrels a day. That's so. I mean, it was actually about 4 days ago on my corner, it was down to $1.99, and now I guess it's up to about $2.15. Yeah, I mean, the fix is in every regard. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to our friends in Northern Ohio. Hey, Kevin from Toledo, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you, Peter, for taking my call.
Thank you. What's up?
Okay, you know what? I'm going to take a... I'm a... conservative Republican. Okay, can we talk? Can we debate for a second?
Oh, yeah. So what? You're like this really wealthy guy?
Oh, hell no. Well, I'm a social worker.
You're a social worker, and Bush is cutting back all the funds for this, and you're just like an average middle-class guy who's getting screwed by Bush, and you're a Republican?
No, see, you know what? I'm a college graduate. I'm a construction worker. But, see, Peter, I'm also smarter than... I'm not going to follow the whole, like, Democratic mantra and... say Bush died, people died, all right? I was fire service, all right? Please, we have a nice conversation about this, all right? And thank you for also listening, bye. But anyway, as the last I talked, Bush
what?
Is a communist? He's a communist? I mean, come on. You know, a communist is a party, all right?
You know what that is, actually, Kevin? It's a way that people mean dictatorship. It could be said better. But essentially, we've been taught all of our life the democratic processes based on the rule of law. And then there's also arbitrary government, which one man or a single party rules. Hello?
Hi, Peter. No, Peter, I understand. Hello, Peter. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, I understand. I think most people like in Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan, right? I don't want to say we're Democrats or Republicans, but I think we're... like moderate conservative people. I mean, we have conservative values. I mean,
Wait a minute. You're speaking for all these people in Northern Ohio, and I mean Toledo is a Democratic Party stronghold for one thing.
I know it is. I mean, I'm a minority here, right?
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, I think that we're all Michigan fans, Tiger fan, Lions fans, right? But that's irrelevant right now. But
have you been drinking?
A little bit. So, yeah, that's what I talked a little.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought, Kevin. You know what? Stop drinking so much when you're thinking about politics, and think about your pocketbook, think about some ethics, even think about traditional conservative values, and forget about Bush Co. All right, he's just for the rich guys, and he's screwing everything up. Wow. All right. Gee, what a genius I am that I figured out he was drinking. Right? Peter Werby here with you on WRIF. Open lines for you at 313-298-WRIF. Come on, didn't anybody at all see, the 60 Minutes deal? I'm still flailing around here trying to find the most extraordinary example of what has been passed under this torture bill. Well, it actually has to do with sexual torture being permissible and affirmed by one of Bush's biggest supporters. I can't think of his first name. It's Professor Yu, Y-O-O, and he wrote a lot of these torture memos in the a few years ago, saying that Bush didn't have to be governed by the Geneva Accords that tell you how you can act within war. And all of a sudden, it has just disappeared from everywhere I've been looking. All right, well, let's do this. Let's take a break, and then we'll be right back to get your calls. But in the meantime, 313-298-WRIF.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eats. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
I've got to stand on my hands. You are the one to offer. Yes, I've finally found a reason. Now I need an excuse. I've got to stand on my hands. You are the one to offer. Yes, I've finally found a reason. Now I need an excuse. I've got.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. I guess in between the time we just spoke, 3 or 4 minutes ago, I have not been declared an enemy combatant, so I still can speak my mind. But who knows what's going to happen here. Here's what could happen. The Republicans and Bushko lose both houses of Congress. And right away, some of them are going to introduce bills of impeachment for Bush lying about the reasons for getting into the war in Iraq, for illegally wiretapping, and I can't remember all the crimes. I don't have a research staff, so a lot of these people, they get somebody, they'll say, list all the Bush crimes, right? And then you got a staff doing it. And so you can help me always. 313-298-WRIF. So now this bill, among other things, by the way, overrules the 1996 War Crimes Act, because Bush essentially has, there's a word for it, a legal word for it, I can't think of it right now, but anything that they, meaning he being the commander-in-chief, so any kind of illegal torture, these murders of prisoners that have occurred, these secret prisons, all of this stuff. We now have a torture staff, just like Egypt or Syria or Kazakhstan or something like that. So we have U.S. men and women who, they call them interrogators, but they're torturers, as we come to find out what's been done to them. Although the new law says you can't rape or disfigure any prisoner. That's good to know, because I'll tell you, without that law, I'd probably rape and disfigure any prisoner that was under my control. That is, of course I wouldn't. And of course, 99% of the people wouldn't. Let's see. It broadens the definition of unlawful enemy combatant. Oh, I didn't finish my thought. So the Congress comes in. The Democrats in the House, some of them could very well be Detroit's own John Conyers, introduce a bill of impeachment. And for sure, they're going to start investigations. They're going to start investigations of all these scams. Like, for instance, this convicted lobbyist, Jack Abramoff, had hundreds of calls that he made to the White House. I mean, which turn the government into a 100% racket for his clients and hundreds of others as well. But anyway, this torture bill broadens the definition of unlawful enemy combatant to include not only those who fight the United States, but also those who have, quote, purposefully and materially supported hostilities against the United States. Well, of course I don't do that, but could they interpret that? I mean, I've had people say, well, you're supposed to tell me. Or something like that. But what if then, say in December, just right before Bushko realizes that the game is up, that everything that they've done, every slimy deal, every law they've broken is going to be exposed in a couple of weeks, and suddenly, terrorist attack in the United States. Well, you got to declare martial law. You got to suspend habeas corpus for everybody, and then you have to declare all critics of the government unlawful enemy combatants. I mean, they might take Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, people like that from the Democratic Party, away in handcuffs, because Halliburton is also building detention centers in this country. It's probably for the illegal immigrants, of course, not for any of us. But let's see. The latter group could include those accused of providing financial or other indirect support to terrorists. What is indirect support to terrorists? One of the things that laws have to have is to have clarity that the average person can understand it. Now, when I was about a year and a half ago, when I decided as a journalist I was going to go to Cuba, which most people can't go unless they have what they call a special license. There's a general exclusion called a general license that allows journalists to go. And so I wanted to go so I could get an idea of what was going on and so I could report back to you, as I've done any number of times and written articles and all of that. But I was still worried that they might try to do a number on me. So I called, I won't say the group for a lot of reasons, but I called this group in New York and subsequently became very friendly with the man who heads it. But he said, have you read the State Department regulation? And I said, yes, I have. He said, do you understand it? I said, I can't understand it, the language. In other words, who's allowed to go under what conditions as a journalist? So he said, I'm an attorney and I don't understand it. So that's one of the defenses, of course. And they said anything that would happen to me if they tried to fine me or whatever they do. They don't charge you criminal stuff. They fine you. That they would take the case partially based. The main thing would be that I'm a legitimate journalist. But the other thing is that the law is so unclear. Same thing here. What is indirect support to terrorists? The designation can be made by any competent tribunal. Any competent tribunal. I mean, isn't this land supposed to be ruled by Congress? Doesn't Congress make the law? And then the president either approves or vetoes it. And then you can challenge that law, any law, through the courts. That's all gone. That's all gone. Now you're going to have any competent tribunal created by, guess who? The president or Secretary of Defense. Donald Rumsfeld can now create a competent tribunal that can decide what is indirect support to terrorists. You can't tell me that people that actually call themselves conservatives and are constitutionalists and know the Constitution can say this is a very cool thing. I mean, we do have something called the Bill of Rights, right? And it calls for speedy trials and stuff like that. And the fact that habeas corpus, in other words, the demand that an individual can have or through his representatives, legal representatives, be brought before a court and say, here's why we have in the court and we're not raping you or disfiguring you because we don't want to break the law. But according to this, I was looking for this thing from prisonplanet.com. It was really hidden away. It was in my hands. But Yale law professor Bruce Ackerman states in the LA Times, the compromise legislation that got passed authorizes the president to seize American citizens as enemy combatants, even if they have never left the United States. And once thrown into a military prison, they cannot expect to trial their peers or any other of the normal protections of the Bill of Rights. Now, this is making the assumption. Some people say, well, I don't want another 9/11. Well, if Bush would have been on the ball, there never would have been a 9/11. I mean, forget about Clinton. You think Clinton had some responsibility? He didn't do anything, absolute zero. I don't care about Clinton. Let's start with January 20th, 2001. That's where a guy named George W. Bush was, when he was sworn in as president. He became commander-in-chief, and from then till September 11th was responsible for the security of the United States. All right. Law professor Marty Letterman says, this subsection of the definition of unlawful enemy combatant means that if the president says you're an unlawful enemy combatant, using whatever criteria they wish, again, the rule of law gone. Then as far as Congress and the U.S. law is, you are one, whether or not you have had any connection to hostilities at all. Now, there was a debate last December with Notre Dame professor and international human rights scholar Castle and John Yoo. Now, John Yoo, that was the guy I was trying to think of earlier, John Y-O-O, and they call him John Torture You. So John Torture You gave the green light to the scope of torture that could be legally included, which included, I mean, get ready for this. You're going to think this is a stretch. The sexual torture of infants. This is what happens in Uzbekistan, one of our erstwhile enemies in the war on terror, and Kazakhstan. They do stuff like that. Now, here's the way it went. Castle. If the president deems that he's got to torture somebody, including by crushing the testicles of the person's child, there is no law that can stop him. You, no treaty. Castle, also no law by Congress. That is what you wrote in 2002 memo. You, I think it depends on why the president thinks he needs to do that. These are men that inhabit the highest realms of power in this United States. that are not willing to say, hey, you're being outrageous. And it's typical of someone like you to bring the most outrageous example possible, because nothing like that could ever happen, and you know it. But the man that wrote these torture memos for Bush and Cheney is saying, well, it depends. Now, torturing children in front of their parents is probably one of the most hideous things that anyone ever could imagine. And this is done in any number of countries around the world, some of which the United States has dispatched prisoners to as part of this whole rendition, what they call taking enemy combatants. And, of course, we find out anywhere from 70 to 90% of them have nothing to do with torture, or excuse me, with terrorism. People, we're in a bad state. Now, one of the things we can do, and Shannon, who's here, reminded me, and I think quite accurately, there is a call essentially for a general strike this coming Thursday, October 5th. You can go to worldcantwait.net. Don't put in the apostrophe. Worldcantwait.net. Or better yet, in a way, they wouldn't think so, but I do. Go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, because all this stuff that I've been talking about is right there on my site as well. And you can also hook up to this effort that's going to happen Thursday. So we've become this officially this torture state, that we have destroyed the balance of power, the checks and balances that we all learned about in high school. And this is all thrown down the drain. Why? Well, primarily because they want to show they can do it. They want to collect the kind of power that previously was only held in the hands of king. And what was the name of the king that the colonists revolted against? What was it? King Philip? No, that was French. King Peter? No, that was Yugoslavia. King George. That's right. It was King George. That was in 1776. And the people, in their uprising against King George, forced him to recognize the constitutional regime that we have today, that where people are guaranteed. Well, that's what being called for on October 5th. Can we do it? I think this is going to wind up to be a gesture, but I'm willing to be more than a part, because a lot of us can't leave our jobs as individuals. Usually when general strikes occur, there's such a massive outpouring. The other night I interviewed Craig Murray, who was a former English ambassador to Uzbekistan, who quit over the tortures that were being carried out, some of them on the behest of the United Kingdom, including, and I hate to even say things like that, people being boiled alive, trying to torture statements out of them. And they didn't come up with the right statement, they're fried. And, well, let me approach the question. Is this necessary in order to protect ourselves? No. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. None of this, absolutely none of this is necessary. If these people that we suspect, and we now have no way to know because they've been held in captivity for so long without access to lawyers or anything, if we think that, was Sheikh Khalid, I can't remember, I don't have it in front of me, I can't remember, was responsible for 9/11, why isn't he being charged with a federal crime in a federal court or in a state court? I mean, he's a mass murderer. There's laws against that. He can be charged with that. Why does there have to be military tribunals? There's only one place that you have military tribunals. It's called a military dictatorship. All right, here is here's Tim. Tim is calling from Detroit. Tim, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Truly a sad time for the United States with this passage of the Military Commissions Act. I wanted to talk about Bob Woodward, if I could, real quick.
Did you see that tonight?
I didn't see the 60 Minutes interview, but I caught him on C-SPAN. He's completely reversed himself now in Bush at War, which I read. That was his first book in the Bush series. Pretty much acknowledged Bush in his book as being an effective president and going after Iraq and laying out the claim for Bush. In this book that's coming out, I mean, he completely, you know, reverses himself and talks about a lot of the incompetence in the Bush administration. And yet both books cover the same time period.
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't know what happened to him. I mean, he caught a lot of flack from a lot of people who had respect for him and said he had just become a Bush toady.
What's the credibility with this guy? I mean, was he given the benefit of the doubt to Bush at first, knowing what he knew back then, and now that things have gone as they've gone, he's come out and pretty much have told a more accurate version of what went on?
I don't know. It's hard to say. It looks like Bush is so isolated, even with his own within his own government. There's been this revolt of the generals, right? People that were that had been part of the military effort. I'm not talking about individual soldiers. There's certainly enough of those. There's now an Iraq veterans against the war, but I'm talking about generals that
former generals that have come out and have called for Rumsfeld's designation.
Yeah, yeah.
And all sorts of people at the top have really called for, you know, the war to be, if not ended in Iraq immediately, at least for a U.S. troop withdrawal in the Kuwait or Qatar.
Yeah, I hear from The Nation magazine, the revolt of the generals. A revolt is brewing among our retired Army and Marine generals. The dissenters include two generals who led combat troops in Iraq, Major General Charles Swanack Jr., who commanded the 82nd Airborne Division, which has taken big losses, and Major General John Batiste, who led the 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One. These men recently sacrificed their careers by retiring and joining the public protest. They said that Rumsfeld was, quote, not a competent wartime leader who made dismal strategic decisions that resulted. Now, you can't get more of an indictment of this. Here's the Secretary of State, always with this incredible assuredness that comes of wealth and power. This guy owns 6 homes in New Mexico alone. And I think he lives in a slave, I'm trying to remember this, like a slave owner's house. And of course, I don't know. That was a long time ago.
One of those kind of yeah. Southern Bell type houses or something.
Yeah, but here, and now I lost this, he said that his decisions... Rumsfeld's decisions, quote, resulted in the unnecessary deaths of American servicemen and women, our allies, and the good people of Iraq. Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of War, according to these generals who led the 82nd Airborne and the 1st Infantry Division, said that his strategic decisions resulted in the unnecessary deaths of American servicemen and women, our allies, and the good people of Iraq. I mean, what more of an indictment could anyone make?
Well, I think there's a greater indictment in the sense that we're talking about a breach of international law here in terms of a crime against peace. I mean, the Iraq War was completely a violation of all UN resolutions.
Oh, Tim, I hear some sirens. They may be coming for you first. Thank you. You'll have to check that out. Let's see here. Steve's in Southgate. Steve, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
That's one thing I think you're forgetting is that the rules don't apply when you can change them at will.
Yeah. Well, that's called what? One-man rule. And Bush has said before 2001, four separate times he said, my favorite form of government is a dictatorship as long as I'm the dictator. And then he laughed. Yeah, it was like a joke, right? Because he was talking about how messy the process of government was. I don't know why he thought it was messy. Just their corporate pals got together in a room, like wrote the energy bill, and then he signed it. It was as easy as that. But go ahead, Steve. Sorry.
Oh, no. It's, you know, you speak about, you know, going after mostly the Republicans. But, I mean, to me, it's not just them. It's also the Democrats. I can't trust any of them. I think most of them are more out for their own well-being than for the well-being of the people that they claim to serve.
Well, I think the Democrats being so out... being on the outs for so long have actually been divorced from the ruling racket. Normally, in fact, I got fired from a job that I worked for the United Auto Workers on a syndicated show. One of the things they objected to is I was saying that the Democrats were the other half of the ruling racket. And they went, you know, they said, well, you're out of here. And other things as well, that they didn't like what I was saying. But in any event, now the Democrats are pretty divorced from power. And when the Republicans, I mean, they're corrupt, weird twistoids to begin with. So they're falling out. I mean, they're just selling the country out in terms of you know, cronyism and connected up with all these lobbyists and all these sexual scandals and what have you. So the Democrats, by comparison, actually look good for once. But like I said, I'm not voting for Debbie Stabenow after she voted for the torture bill.
Of course not. The one thing that I keep looking at, and it doesn't matter on what side it's conservative or liberal, Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter on what side, everyone's, like I said, it just seems to be more out for themselves than they are for the people, and I'm sitting here at home wondering, without a job, because there are no jobs in Michigan right now,
mm-hmm.
what's going to be the what's the straw that's going to break the camel's back? I mean, you have the president that's basically suspending any law that we have had for the last 200 years that it was founded on this country, and it keeps getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And
well, it does, but here, you never can tell what's going to happen. I mean, why wasn't there a revolution in 1775, for instance, or why didn't people of Romania overthrow Ceausescu the year before they did, or the day before they did? Things build like a pressure cooker, and if they're not addressed, they eventually explode. Hopefully, we don't get to that point. All right, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Let's go back to Northern Ohio and talk to Bob. Bob's in Toledo also. Bob, hi. You weren't with Kevin, were you?
No, sir. Okay. I'd just like to speak to you about what there was back in my social studies class.
Yeah.
Back a while back in a community college.
Okay.
Well, they talked about how they were, you know, politically the politically minded people, like in on the West Coast or whatever, what have you. They were in prisons and.
Oh, the Japanese.
I'm not sure. No, these were American women that they were abusing for political, you know, crimes and misdemeanors.
Okay, I don't know what this is, but go ahead.
You know, I was wondering if you knew anything about that. Did you ever hear anything about that, or did they sweep that under the rug as well?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't think they swept it under the rug. A good history book, if you have never seen it, is Howard Zinn, Z-I-N-N, Howard Zinn, People's History of the United States. That'll be a book that'll be like a life-changing book. It sold over 1 million copies. Most history books, and some of them are assigned. But most history books, yeah, they sell 25,000, 50,000, something like that. Popular writers, maybe even 100,000. But this one by Howard Zinn is a bestseller. I mean, a wild bestseller. All right, but check it out. I'll check it out. Thank you, Bob. Let's see here. This is by Elizabeth Holtzman. Elizabeth Holtzman, what was she? A former New York congresswoman. That's right. Isn't she going to run for vice president or something like that? Hey, by the way, we're almost to a break, but you can call in at 313-298-WRIF. She writes, this is called Bush Seeks Retroactive Immunity for Violating War Crimes Act. 32 years ago, President Gerald Ford created a political firestorm storm by pardoning former President Richard Nixon of all crimes he may have committed in Watergate and lost his election as a result in 1976. Now, President Bush, to avoid a similar public outcry, is quietly trying to pardon himself of any crimes connected with the torture and mistreatment of U.S. detainees, because what he allowed is prohibited by the 1996 War Crimes Act. The pardon is buried in Bush's proposed legislation, though, so this was before it passed, to create a new kind of military tribunal for cases involving top al-Qaeda operatives. The pardon provision has nothing to do with the tribunals. Instead, it guts the War Crimes Act of 1996, a federal law that makes it a crime, in some cases punishable by death, to mistreat detainees in violation of the Geneva Conventions, and makes the law makes the new weaker terms of the War Crimes Act retroactive to 9/11, specifically exonerating the kind of abusive behavior, including death, carried out under Bush as commander-in-chief of people completely innocent of any crime. And besides, even if you're guilty, you can't do that to people. That's why there is international law. That's why there's the Geneva Accord. That's why the Republicans passed, a Republican-dominated Congress in 1996, passed the War Crimes Act. Press accounts of the provision have described it as providing immunity for CIA interrogators, but its terms cover the president and other top officials because the act applies to any U.S. national. Avoiding prosecution under the War Crimes Act has been an obsession of this administration since shortly after 9/11. Now, this is incredible. We have a president of the United States that's doing everything he can so that he doesn't get prosecuted as a war criminal. And one of the things that this new book, State of Denial, brings out, speaking about war criminals, is that he's being advised by Henry Kissinger. This is the architect of Vietnam and the fascist takeover of Chile. Wow. Hold on. We'll be right back.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it. Double shots of rock.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Is WRIF.com.
Yeah.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. We'll do this hour open line phones at 313-298-WRIF and then at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, if you're elsewhere in the world or in the country, you can do the math and figure out when it is. Our first interview will be with Carol Leigh, L-E-I-G-H, and she's written a book called Unrepentant Whore. And she's actually, as I found out, currently a prostitute as well. But she has been active in the prostitute rights movement or the sex workers. She doesn't even like the phrase. She talks about that in the interview. Sex worker rights. And then Pun Plamondon, the old White Panther, John Sinclair's group in Ann Arbor, and his men. So we're going to have that on at 1:30. Coming up next Saturday is, in fact, this is connected to that, that there's going to be a commemoration of the 40th anniversary of the opening of the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit. This was a rock and roll venue for those of you either very young or far away that had every single rock great imaginable. You could go hear Cream with Eric Clapton for $5. Now you can go out to Pine Knob, or what do they call it now, DTE Energy Theater, and you can see Aerosmith for $450. What's going on here? A lot of stuff like that. Hey, by the way, this hour of Night Call is brought to you by Waking Up, the sweatshop free clothing store at the Universal Mall in Warren, 13 Mile into Quinder, or you can go to wakingupstore.com. It's going to be closed for the World Can't Wait, what's my noun here, event. It's supposed to be more in a protest. It's the theme of it, Drive Out the Bush Regime. You go to worldcantwait.net. Don't put in the apostrophe. And these are events that are going on in over 150 cities. And it's the model of a general strike that actually could remove a president who, A, got in power twice by illegally stealing elections, and B, creating an illegal war, a crime against peace, which is a international war crime, has set up a network of illegal secret prisons where prisoners are tortured, and we found out 70-90% of them actually have had nothing to do with terrorism, and now has pushed through a bill in Congress that would codify all this to establish one-man rule instead of statutory law or the Constitution. So, drive out the Bush regime, sure. WorldCan'tWait.net. All right. Where did I see this one email here? CallTalkYes@Yahoo.com. Adam in Romulus writes, until last week, I delivered pizza in Dearborn. Of course, many of my customers were Muslims. Do you think I could be labeled an enemy combatant if one of the people I made a delivery to turned out to be an enemy combatant themselves? I don't know, Adam. You might. I'm glad you got out. Now you're probably safe. Dave from Dearborn, who I don't know whether he's an enemy combatant or not, may soon be, that he alerted us to this. And I remember this was in the works. The U.S. House has passed by a voice vote a bill that would allow schools to strip search children for drugs without parental consent. Shannon Caldwell is with me, who is a mother of how many kids? Five?
Two.
All right. Sorry. I mean, I just saw your mouth drop open there.
Yeah. You know, anytime they start talking about doing stuff to kids, you know, what you were talking about earlier with the torturing of children and even torturing them in front of their own parents and then this strip searching, pretty much anytime you put strip and children together into one sentence, my stomach turns.
Sure. The bill now goes to the Senate. The bill also absolves those conducting the searches from all legal and criminal liability. There's a pattern here. This is what the torture bill that the Congress just passed, Bush's bill, that now makes the thinking about those tigers, makes the U.S. Sorry, I'm a guy. Come on, Shannon, give me a break. That makes the U.S. officially a terror state. A terror state. Dave writes, the cowards passed this with a voice vote so people cannot find out how their representative voted. Hopefully, the Senate will say no to it. All right, let's go back to some phone calls. Well, I don't know. I like Toledo. Dan's in Toledo. Dan, are you drinking with Kevin?
No, I don't even know Kevin, Peter.
Okay.
I spend 2 hours every Sunday night in my car because it's the only way I can get riffed and listen to you. So I'm sitting in my car in front of a building hoping the cops don't pull up and ask me what I'm doing. But I got two questions for you, if I may.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here listening to you.
So I thought I lost you. Chavez, there was a thing on, you know, I watch a TV program like you do. I'll flip through it just because I'm doing it, you know, not really paying attention. But there was a thing from Saturday Night Live. I don't know if it's got to be current, that I just happened to catch. I caught part of the skit, so I don't know how it started. But the skit apparently was supposed to be Chavez having some kind of a meeting with leaders of Iran, North Korea, and I'm forgetting what the third country was. I want to say Iraq, but I'm not even sure because they didn't say much with them. But, I mean, mocking the leaders of these countries and trying to make some kind of an impression that there is some kind of alliance between these people.
Well, what happens is for instance, in Havana, there was, I forgot how many countries, 120 countries that met in what they called the unaligned nations, in that they don't subject their domestic policies or their foreign policy to that of the United States, who tries to control all countries across the world. For instance, there's supposed to be an election in Nicaragua, and a congressman went down there. I thought I had that story here, but I guess I don't. And told the Nicaraguan people that if you, I wonder what the hell is his name, Daniel Ortega, the guy who was a Sandinista in the 80s and still is, who's got probably a good chance of being elected president. Again, elected is the key word here. And so Bushko sends down a representative to say, hey, we're going to, you know, the family is not going to like this. We're going to cut off all this aid. So there's all this interference in the affairs of other countries. The most blatant one is the invasion of Iraq, of course. But let me say this. Hugo Chavez is the legally elected president and democratically elected president of Venezuela. I think it's unseeing for him to embrace Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who is the president of Iran. Although elected, he runs an extraordinarily repressive regime. He's a right-winger. He's a right-wing religious fanatic, like the whole leadership of Iran. So what is Chavez, who is religious? He's a Christian. He's a Catholic, and he's committed to democratic rights, contrary to the lies that come out of the press, and or usually just repeating what Bush says. So why is he hugging this guy? I mean, you can get the thing, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, but that puts you oftentimes in league with with a lot of people that are pretty unsavory. All right, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Oh, well, gee, a lot of... a lot of interesting people ahead, it looks like. Good. You want to join them? 313-298-WRIF. And speaking of Iran, here's Scott in Westland that wants to tell us quickly about the Iran nuclear program.
Well, I guess I'm not even going to try and pronounce his name, but the leader of Iran that you just mentioned in a very recent speech called the Bush policy toward Iran a big lie. And I think that's pretty ironic. He took the words right out of my mouth. I think a lot of people have their own definitions of what the, quote, big lie, unquote, is. But my definition is the old Atomic Energy Commission slogan, Atoms for Peace.
Sure.
This is the myth that pervades this whole debate about the Iranian nuclear program, that somehow if they cooperate with us and we give them yellow cake uranium, they can have nuclear reactors and stuff like that, but they're not going to get the bomb. But the problem is, I know this is not true because we went through this with Pakistan. You know, all these lies were floated, you know, about Pakistan, and that used to be the looming, you know, Islamic bomb. But hey, you know, the fact is, if Iran has any kind of nuclear program at all, if they're operating nuclear power plants, they're going to get the bomb sooner or later.
Sure, and it makes sense, as I've said so many times in this broadcast, if you have no weapons of mass destruction, since Iraq had none and the U.S. knew they didn't, you get invaded. If you have them, and you even threaten the United States, like North Korea did, the United States says, well, let's have some negotiations. Let's talk about this. So it would make sense, particularly when Israel, which whenever a country in a region has a nuclear weapon, like India did, and then Pakistan wanted to get it as a hedge against India. Well, if Israel has it illegally, by the way, and never even admits it, that they have it, well, then the other countries want to have it because they're afraid that the United States and or Israel will attack them. And one of the things the United States could do is say, let's have a peace treaty. Let's sign an international treaty that agrees that the United States will never invade Iran unless Iran invades the United States. And Israel could do the same. Except, you know what? They would never do it. So who really is responsible for the tension in that area? You know, we have this Ahmadinejad, you know, who everybody's like, he's mad, you know, he's all this. Well, he is a list of my favorite politicians, which is a pretty short list to begin with, but he's not the central cause of problems in that region. The main player that's the central cause of problems in the Middle East is a country that has no business being there at all and is being run right now by George W. Bush. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here is Joel. Joel's in Wayne. Hi, Joel. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
You know, as far as the United States government passing this bill on torture again, you know, I'm a parent myself, and I got to tell you, I see it not only with our schools that the government's trying to run your kids, but yet to torture a child for a suspected terrorist. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm a former service member of this country. And I got to tell you, with this administration, I don't like the way things are going, number one. Number two, what does torturing an innocent child have to do with the war on terror?
Well,
what did a child do to deserve that?
Nothing.
Yeah,
let me say this. In fairness, Joel, I don't think that the United States is going to torture children. But according to this author of all these torture memos, he wouldn't say it wasn't possible. It gives you an idea of the arbitrariness of all of this. I'm not trying to say that Bush is going to start torturing children in front of their parents.
I hope not.
But no, I hope not too. But here you have this professor that it was a Bush advisor saying that there's no treaty, and he says, I think it depends. Let me just reset this for people that haven't heard it. This Notre Dame professor says if the president deems that he's got to torture somebody, including by crushing the testicles of the person's child, there is no law that can stop him. Professor John Yoo, again, he's the advisor to Bush, no treaty. Also no law by Congress. That is what you wrote in August 2002. And Professor Yoo says, I think it depends on why the president thinks he needs to do that.
I mean, as far as that goes, I mean, you know, this whole thing, I mean, let's look at the situation here. Iraq. Whatever happened to going and getting Bin Laden, the one that orchestrated the attacks in 9/11, the president has admittedly said, oh, I don't think about him that much. This is the gentleman that orchestrated and planned these attacks and killed thousands of innocent people, yet you don't worry about him, but you're more worried about Iraq.
Well, you know, Joel, I make the assumption, like you do, and probably every American, that Osama bin Laden was, in fact, the mastermind of all of this. But, you know, it's weird. He's never been charged. Why isn't there an international arrest warrant charging him with mass murder and, fugitive flight warrant? It's very odd. And these other 14 guys that have just been moved out of these secret prison hells, as described by people that have been in them, that have been entirely innocent. Why haven't they been charged previously? And it's like I said earlier, why wouldn't they be tried in New York State Court? Why wouldn't they be charged in Federal Court, District of New York? Doesn't make a bit of sense. Thank you, Joel. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go up to Fenton, Michigan. Ted, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
How you doing?
Doing great.
I just wanted to say, one of your earlier callers said that they couldn't trust any politician. That's kind of how I feel. And in my past, I was more conservative. I guess I would still consider myself conservative now. But who do you trust, honestly? I mean, if you're going right-wing, left-wing, I don't feel like you can trust anybody.
Well, I know what you mean. Here, in 2004, I, in my entire life, had never voted for a Democrat for president. Certainly never voted for a Republican. But I thought Kerry was so extraordinarily weak, and although the Democrats hated it, people said he was waffling, he was. He was under enthrall to all these consultants and said, you got to do this, you got to wear that, and all of that. He's a very weak candidate, and he almost won. In fact, I would say he did win, got cheated out of it, but whatever. It was pretty close. And still, in this election, I think it's extraordinarily important that that Bushko get sent back on its heels. I don't think the, you know, some people think, oh, they'll get the Democrats in and everything will read into this wonderful state of affairs, and every bad law that Bush passed and every executive order that he put in that threatens workers' rights and workers' safety and the environment and kids' health and all that will all go away in a minute. Well, I don't think so for a minute. But to affirm this this illegal regime and all of the laws that it's passing by allowing a Republican Congress to continue, I think would be disastrous.
Well, Peter, I was also wondering, were you reading from Bob Woodward's book, or were you reading from the actual law? Or,
when?
When I was probably about 25 minutes ago, you're reading about the torturing and that sort of thing, that this new law.
No. This was what I was reading from. This, you can go to prisonplanet.com and find this. And it was a quote from a debate between a Notre Dame professor and this professor from Berkeley, John Yoo, Y-O, who was the author of many of these memos that happened right after 2001, where Bush was told by this professor Yoo that he did not have to follow the Geneva Accords in terms of how prisoners were treated. And, of course, the military is aghast at this because what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. So if this can be done to our prisoners, well, people that would capture our soldiers now or in the future, same thing could happen to them. Ted, thank you so much. Appreciate you calling in. And let's see here. Here is Hank. Hank's in Ypsilanti. Hank, hi. We're beyond WRIF. So are you. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
This whole pressure cooker thing, you're absolutely right on. Jefferson, I think, said that every once in a while people need to revolt and replace the government and that kind of thing.
Sure.
And I think it's getting pretty close to that if things don't turn around, you know?
Well, you know, my favorite quote lately is by V. Remember V for Vendetta, who said that people should not be afraid of their governments. Government should be afraid of their people. Now, if you started, you know, for the first time in my life, I thought, gee, wonder what the hell is going to happen in this country. And I'm not going to, what's that Tom Petty song? I won't back down.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get a postcard in the mail saying there's in 4 or 5 days fascism is going to be established, and so you can stop what you're doing or we'll give you a little head start. That's not what happened in countries where authoritarian rule has been imposed. Authoritarian rule. Look at Thailand, or look at what Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon set in motion in Chile in September 11th, 1973.
You know, everything happens really slow. I mean, like little tiny things. We're going to start here and then we're going to get to there. I'm sure that somebody has thought of this stuff and they're just going through all of the steps to get to the very top, which is, you know, the crazy fascist control type stuff.
Well, Hank, it's actually both. It's death of a thousand cuts in terms of our rights and our democracy and things that we and our fathers and our grandfathers and our great-grandfathers and mothers, sorry, that they were, you know, that our ancestors have fought for the last, since the revolution, because when the United States government began in 1789, they immediately started passing laws saying you couldn't criticize the government, and Samuel Adams, who was the first conservative president, it passed these what they called alien and sedition laws, sedition meaning critical of the government, and he closed all these newspapers. Well, fortunately, there was the Supreme Court that held that this that these laws couldn't stand. And there's been times in the United States before, some of the worst under a Democratic president during World War One, that unions were destroyed and people that weren't citizens were just rounded up and sent back to Europe, and civil rights and civil liberties were trampled on. But we were in a war then. But it was used. It was used by Wilson, and it was used in other times in our history to trample dissent, because governments hate dissent. They hate people exposing their lies. They hate people exposing their crimes. And as we saw, when there's absolute rule, put them in jail forever. Don't bring any charges against them. Torture them. And that's why the founding fathers had all those amendments, saying you had free speech, you had to give people speedy trials, you couldn't torture them, cruel and unusual punishment, and a host of other things that they tried to remedy what they saw in Europe and what they saw the absolute right of kings doing to a people. So now we've moved, all of a sudden, we're back there. You said it's slow, so then I said it's the death of a thousand cuts, but sometimes it's boom. And this is a boom. It's detainee law. All right, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. CallTalkYes@yahoo.com. I really have much with that, but I will at least read them myself. Okay, let's go to Al in Inkster. Al, hi. Peter Werbe, you're on the air. Al.
Hello, how are you?
Al, come on, dude. Either you were eating or, because you know the drill here. Go ahead, you're on the air. What happened to, that's so un-Al. Al's one of our regulars. We usually don't do... Anyway, it wasn't the person I was supposed to take next. This is Chris from Grosse Pointe Woods. Chris, is it you that I met out at the Green Expo?
No, I'm sorry. It must have been a different Chris.
Different Chris from he's from Grosse Pointe. I forgot there's all these different Grosse Pointes.
Yeah, there's Woods Farms, a whole different variety.
But go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I was just wondering about your plan about the treaty between the Middle East and Israel and the rest of the Arab world with the nuclear arms, like our treaty with them of not attacking them unless they attack us. I'm wondering how that would aid us if they were to establish a nuclear program, and then should we wait to be hit first before we retaliate?
Well, why? I mean, Iran has a lot of legitimate long-standing grievances against the United States, primarily going back 50 years when the United States overthrew their democratically elected government and installed this torture state under the Shah, which, of course, this is one of these long-range things that United States policymakers think they're so smart and they can use their power and extend it way across the world to protect the world. But what it turns out is to come back to bite us in the ass. So when finally this, pardon me, this torture state that we set in power, and it's not just the Republicans we were saying earlier. Jimmy Carter had New Year's dinner with the Shah of Iran in like 1978 or 1979, talking about he was this, you know, bastion of the free world. So then we, you know, there's a revolution finally, and we get these people that hate us. Why wouldn't they? But even given that, why in the world would you think that Iran would attack the United States? I mean, that's preposterous on the face of it.
Oh, I completely understand you 100%. They would, I sincerely doubt that they would attack the United States. My fear would be that they would start pressuring other countries, and that we're putting, I'm also feeling like we are putting too much emphasis on this war altogether. I mean, I think there are much more pressing issues at hand, like people are talking about in the impeachment of Bush because of his policies overseas in the Middle East. We need to be more focused on what we can do in the United States with all this outsourcing to China and other things, because the U.S. is currently the leading power. So, yeah, Iran would not attack us. But let's say in a couple decades, half a century or so, we're not doing so well economically and our programs start to falter, then we're going to have to start worrying about other countries coming after us.
Well, maybe we should start, instead of making war for the last 100 years or so, we should start examining what can be done to make peace. I'm not saying, yeah, we can just do it. I mean, what's in place here is a system of belligerent states. And now that we have the power, if you're real big, real strong, you can say, hey, let's not fight. And usually the smaller person is going to say no. But, Chris, do you realize what you did? You actually brought up the economy. Are you insane? No, you're actually right on target. Yeah, I mean, all of this gets just blown away. United States now, you and me, by the way, because it's not the United States, we fund the United States, is spending $8 billion a month in Iraq. $8 billion a month.
I agree completely with you. I mean, we should spend on regulating our military, and I don't agree. I'm not saying that we should be over there and doing what we're doing, because I don't think it's being handled adequately. But I don't also believe the other side where Bush should be, to the point where he's impeached. I do believe things could be being handled a bit better, and we could start withdrawing from Iraq. We don't really need to keep sending people over there. We should be downsizing and allowing them to put what they need their government into place.
Well, right now, the United States under George W. Bush in Iraq is damned if they do and damned if they don't. I mean, the policy is so failed that some people have said, well, they just put 350,000 men in there. I mean, we had like 500,000 at a time in Vietnam. Interestingly, though, that people actually would say Vietnam, because we had 500,000 men in there and we were losing hundreds of men a week and finally got driven out of there. So the difference today, though, is that they don't have the troops. There's no way in the world they can do it. All right, Chris, thank you. Thanks for joining us. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Al has finished his meal in Inkster and is ready to talk to us.
Actually, I was giving the dog a belly rub.
All right. I can go for that.
And it's the economy, stupid. We keep letting the Chinese finance our war at $8 billion a month. You know, they're going to end up calling in the bill soon.
Well, I don't know that they can, because we owe them so much money. If they finally faced reality and said that it doesn't look like we can meet our payments. This happened when the United States had a lot of debtors in Latin America, like in the 70s. They weren't ever going to get the money. They were lucky at the debt service, but they, you know, we always had that kind of on the books and banks as well, through the IMF and the World Bank. They still, you know, counted it as creditors, or as what? Debtors, right? Legitimate.
We're the debtor. They're the creditor.
Now it's reversed. We're a debtor nation. Bush has driven us into debt, and see, I don't understand this. I mean, it's some, like, mass psychology thing, because you would think that even if people liked Bush, I mean, not very many of us do anymore, or supported his policies, not many of us do anymore, but even those remaining people would think, this guy's costing me a lot of money. When Clinton left, there was a surplus. Now there's a deficit, so every time I pay taxes, it's a couple of really bad places. One, $2 billion a week is going into the rat hole of Iraq. I mean, a lot of the U.S. corporations are benefiting from this, obviously. A lot of it gone in corruption. But then the other thing is, in order to finance the government, we have to keep borrowing from Asian banks and some European banks just to make it go. So every time my taxes aren't even going, like, for a war, they're going to some banker in another country as interest. Don't you think that would make people not like Bush?
That makes me not like him, you know. I don't want that. I have a hard enough time paying my own bills, you know. I hope he's got caller ID so he can avoid the calls from the Chinese bankers, you know.
All right, Al, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Here's Dan. Dan is in Milford. Dan, hi. Peter Werby, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Good, thanks.
Hey, why do you ignore the facts of the Geneva Convention, that it only applies to an organized, uniformed military? Terrorists are to be shot on sight.
You show me where in the Geneva Convention that says that. Do you ever hear of Light Horse Lee?
No.
Okay. Well, you need to read some American history. He led a guerrilla force in the Carolinas during the War of Independence. He didn't have a uniform, and instead of frontal warfare, he shot people, and the British considered him a terrorist and subject to being shot on sight. I mean, you're in the convention. Geneva Convention allows no unarmed person to be hurt in the slightest.
And you're talking about good for the goose, good for the gander. We should cut off their heads and drag them through the streets like they do to us.
Well, the problem with that is, I mean, who's going to do that? If you, Dan, I wonder what kind of human being you are. We can't say to them that ethically we find what they've done reprehensible and then advocate that our troops, of course, I mean, I know you wouldn't do it, but you're advocating that someone else have that kind of deed on their hand and on their conscience. You know, also, not that this in any way alters this, but it wasn't even it wasn't U.S. military. It was these mercenaries that occurred to. These were these, you know, there's a film out called Iraq for Sale. And one of the places that these billions of dollars of our tax money that is going away every week, $2 billion a week, it goes to these so-called security firms. But essentially what they are these mercenaries that have no supervision whatsoever. I mean, they're like U.S. soldiers, any number of U.S. soldiers have been prosecuted because of torturing or murdering civilians. But these guys like from Blackwell and Kaki, C-A-C-I, they have no supervision to speak of whatsoever. So, but answer my question. Are you gonna cut off their head and drag them through the streets?
Well, I certainly can't, but you sit there and worry about their rights.
Well, wait a minute. Who would you like to have do it? Your neighbor? You got a neighbor kid? I got a neighbor kid that joined the Army, and he's going to be over there. Would you like him to be the person that saws off someone's head and drags them his body through the streets?
Well, it's the United States. Of course we can't do that. But I'm just saying, we treat them like kings over here.
Oh, man. You know, Dan, it's like you know nothing. They aren't treated like kings. They are tens of thousands of people that have been subjected to these prisons, 70-90% of which the United States government admits had absolutely nothing to do with anything. A lot of these people, including the people at Guantanamo, were, which they estimate as much as 75 or 80%, had no connection with terrorism whatsoever, have been in this jail for 4 years and were turned in because they were sold to bounty hunters who in turn turned them over to the United States. And sometimes they were done because they were political enemies. Sometimes there were tribal rivalries. But, you know, people judge you by how you react to the worst among us. And, you know, there's people that have been serial killers like Ted Bundy, and I can't remember all the rest of these. And you know what happened? When they're arrested, they're told their rights. They're given a representation. They have a trial. And then some of them, I guess, were executed. But in some cases, they were sentenced to life in prison, and they're not done to what is done in historically. So no one has any sympathy for any terrorists. And if they're terror, which is essentially murder, is a crime. And anyone who's plotting it or anyone who's done it ought to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. It doesn't mean that you have secret prisons where people are tortured, where nobody has rights, access to the judiciary for review. That's what dictatorships have. Right?
Well, you know, you're talking about U.S. citizens under the U.S. law, and you're talking about terrorists that are killing American citizens during wartime. It's a different story. War is hell. I mean, I know it. It's just a miserable. You can never have a war that is humane.
Well, wait a minute. But they do. They have rules. Now, I'm sure in every war, people, soldiers, individual companies whatsoever, carry out war crimes. And we know that happened in Vietnam. We know My Lai was. We know there were some massacres of civilians by U.S. troops in Korea. But that's horrifying to the military command. They don't want that to happen. But there's very specific rules that apply. And because you label somebody a terrorist, that's why I was saying the example of the American Revolution, where you had people that were essentially declared by the British government. I mean, the whole pack of American revolutionaries, our founding fathers, were considered and could have been shot on sight, as you were mentioning before. So, and it's the same thing like with crime. You in areas where people are very criminal, you have like the Chicago police that are essentially torturing confessions out of people in the 1980s. And what you have is people that are going to jail that never committed anything. There's been, for instance, 180 exonerations of people on death row that were set to be executed that never did it. And mainly they were poor people that had no representation. And so what we want is a system of laws, not where one man can declare people enemy combatants and then subject them to some hideous torture. That's not what America is all about. But I thank you, Dan, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com. We'll be right back.
demigod. You fake with things. There's no sex in your violence. No sex in your violence. There's no sex in your violence. There's no sex in your violence. Trust you was my way. Ever since then, ever since then, I don't think so.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. We have open lines, 313-298-WRIF, and at about 1 a.m. Eastern Time, Carol Lee, the unrepentant whore. What? You can go to her website, unrepentantwhore.com. Hey, Shannon, everybody's got to have it. Everybody has a website. Then at 1:30, Pun Plamondon. Who tells the story of his life, pun on the run, for one thing, when he was a federal fugitive and was in Algeria with Black Panther Eldridge Cleaver. It's quite a story. Now, 7-Eleven has dropped Citgo as a gas supplier. 7-Eleven dropped Venezuela-owned Citgo as its gasoline supplier after more than 20 years as part of a previously announced plan by the convenience store operator to launch its own brand of fuel. Citgo Petroleum Corporation is a Houston-based subsidiary of Venezuela's state-run oil company, and 7-Eleven is worried that anti-American comments made by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, remember he called Bush the devil and all that, might prompt motorists to fill up elsewhere. What dope these people are. These stations are jammed now. Most people I know are only buying at Citgo. How about you? Do you have any feelings one way or the other? I mean, do you buy there? Do you not buy it? 313-298-WRIF. Shannon, there's one right near our house, our respective homes. Do you buy there? You get Citgo gas there?
You know, I swear to God, Peter, and this is sick and wrong, and I'm not proud of myself for it, but I buy gas where it's convenient and where it's cheap when I'm almost out of gas.
When
I'm almost out of gas. That's where I bought BP gas the other day. I was thinking, is this right? Should I be buying this BP gas? But my tank was empty. So the answer was, clearly I should buy the gas right here, right now.
As I think you know, that the profits from Citgo go to help the poor in Venezuela and in the United States. Where, I mean, I think I have something here. In fact, Hugo Chavez, the president, the trash-talking Chavez, he's doubling his energy subsidies to the needy in the United States. He's going to offer 100 million gallons of subsidized heating oil to needy Americans. And some of these people are saying, we have to take the Citgo sign down, you know, and all of this. I'm not sure why he, I mean, I don't know. He's kind of the tail of the, tiger. Because Bushko certainly is unhappy. And he says he wants to be friends. Well, that was the other thing. He said that Bush was an alcoholic and a sick man, and he walks like John Wayne.
But we'd love to be friends with him, right?
Yeah.
Nice.
That's unnecessary. He says, one day the people of the United States will choose a president with whom we can talk. You don't know how much I would like to have as a friend the president of the United States. Well, good for you, Hugo. A lot of people calling for a boycott of 7-Eleven, and I've jumped right on board. No more big gulps for me. I'm quitting. I don't know if I've ever been in a 7-Eleven. I have. Actually, I haven't. But the people I know have gone in and gotten coffee. Terrible.
See, and I think of myself, I try, Peter, to stay on the Peter right, to do my very best in, you know, just little things, minor steps, tiny little things that I can do to kind of gum up the system to make the right choice time and time again.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so guilty of being such a creature of habit, just like the rest of us are, and a creature of convenience. If it's inconvenient for me, and I'm not proud of it, Peter, like I told you before, remember when my car got crashed? My car, and my whole plan, and for months and months, I had been planning a protest. You know how I ride my bicycle to work here, right? And you make fun of me for riding my bike to work, Mr. Don't put your money into the gasoline, right? Okay? You live just as close as I do, but you take your car. So anyway,
well,
I digress.
You have your Wicked Witch of the West bicycle.
Hey, it works.
Yeah.
It works beautifully, and it's actually it's a classic.
It's
from the 70s.
I have my Vetus aluminum frame with Campy and Dura-Ace.
And how long has it been since that's been out of the garage,
yeah, a little
Mr.
while.
Werby? Yeah, so my car gets crashed, and my whole plan was fantastic. Finally, this is an opportunity for me to protest this gasoline, right? I can live in Detroit, go for 1 week until my car hopefully gets repaired without using any gasoline at all.
Right.
I won't hitch a ride with anyone. If I need to get there, I'll take my bike. I got baskets to stick on my bike. And within 2 days, Miss Bullheaded, I'm going to ride my bike, was just jonesing for a car.
Yeah,
so I
tough.
Borrowed a Bronco. Nice.
Well, it's tough. Hey, one of the things, though, people calling for this boycott of 7-Eleven, they really agreed to do it. For one thing, Citgo, which has about 1,800 independent stations, they couldn't even supply them all. They had to purchase 130,000 barrels a day from third parties. And this was worked out a long time ago with 7-Eleven. And essentially what they were doing, 7-Eleven, was they were just trying to look good. 7-Eleven spokeswoman Margaret Chabrice says, regardless of politics, we sympathize with many Americans' concern over derogatory comments about our country and its leadership recently made by Venezuela's president. He never said anything bad about the country at all. Let's see. Let's go to Tim. Tim's in Rochester Hills. And go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for calling us. Oh, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. This is one of these things where you got to press the button, don't you? Go ahead, Tim. You're on the air.
No problem. Thanks a lot. Hey, Citgo Gas, there's one kind of by my house, but, you know, I go to Speedway, and, you know, I have the Speedy Rewards card, so I'll kind of go out of my way for that because it helps me out. You get the prices off of gas, and they're just as big as 7-Eleven, so, you know, I mean, I haven't been to 7-Eleven in a while. I didn't realize they were that tied to Venezuela. You know, it seems kind of crazy.
They actually, let me see, in here, there's a mutual agreement of the two countries, but Citgo was founded as City Services, the Southland Corporation bought Citgo from Occidental Petroleum in 1983. 7-Eleven sold half its interest in Citgo and the remaining stake in 1990 to Petróleos de Venezuela, S.A., or however they would say it, S.A. So that Citgo used to be owned by 7-Eleven, and they sold it to the Venezuelan government. So it's, you know, it's just a lot of ways, a lot of corporate maneuvering. But the Venezuelans are not unhappy at all that Citgo is cutting them loose because they're having trouble, getting gasoline for them. All right, thank you. Here's Jim in Dearborn. Jim, hi. Peter Werby, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Good.
Actually, before I get to my main point, I've never heard you mention, I don't know if you're aware, that Blackwater, the mercenary group in Iraq, is owned by Dick DeVos's brother-in-law.
Come on.
It's true. I don't know his first name, but his last name is Prince. It's Betsy DeVos's brother, and
wow.
He owns Blackwater.
You know, I was just saying, Shannon, who was talking earlier, was being nice and said, yeah, I'm not even needed anymore. Everything is out there. If people still have some allegiance to this racket in Washington, I don't even know what to say. More information is not going to help them. Do you think?
People just stick their head in the sand, and they don't want to know anything.
Yeah. Jim, you have a comment on the military tribunals?
Well, yeah, I think the whole point is with Bush that, you know, with the he wouldn't use the FISA court because he didn't have proof to show the court why he wanted to eavesdrop on people.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to go to the court with any terrorists because he has no proof that they are terrorists. It's just, it's his word that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. Just trust me, it's true. Trust me, they're terrorists. Trust me, these people are talking to Al-Qaeda on the phone. And he's got no proof of anything.
I know. And FISA, by the way, what is the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978 that set up a secret court, which is pretty dicey for a democracy to begin with. But this allowed that the president to bring evidence, essentially to get wiretap warrants. And there was an emergency provision that, for instance, the people found out, boy, there's going to be some attack, that they could begin wiretapping without approval, without a warrant, and then quickly bring the evidence, as you're saying, Jim, to the FISA court, as it's called, and say, here's why we wiretapped them. We want to get your post hoc approval. So you're right. Millions of people have been under illegal surveillance, and Judge Taylor, the federal judge, Anna Diggs Taylor in Detroit, for some reason or other, who ruled that was unconstitutional, gave Bush another week that would expire this coming week to, I don't know, I guess to present proofs or something like that. But the whole idea, and we were, well, I can't remember his name, from Milford, you get the idea, well, you have to believe Bush, that if we don't, remove these constitutional guarantees, if we don't wiretap people, if we don't do everything that Bush wants, including give him one-man rule, the power of one-man rule, then somehow we're limiting our ability to stop terrorism, which is just a cracker, right?
Yeah, it's...
Don't finish my sentence, please.
No, yeah. But he says, you know, tens of thousands of people in America are talking to Al-Qaeda. Why aren't they in jail?
Yeah, exactly. Why? Well, I said earlier, why hasn't Osama bin Laden been indicted? Why haven't these 14 guys that they removed from these secret prisons and where, you know, Gaia knows what was done to them, and why aren't they charged with anything? And why are they being tried before military tribunals?
Yeah, because he has no proof that they did anything. So
yeah.
It's just, if they go, the way he wants it set up is, if we say they're terrorists and they're convicted. We don't need to show any proof of anything.
That's pretty dangerous. That's not the way it works in a democratic society. Well, thank you very much, Jim. Thanks for having joined us and your opinions. I can't believe this, that during this whole program, nobody called in and said that I saw the 60 Minutes deal with Bob Woodward and talking about his book, State of Denial, that says that Bush ignored urgent warnings on Iraq. Does this sound familiar? Where else did he ignore an urgent warning? Gee, could it have been about September 11th? Remember in August, he's clearing brush. And he was the guy that said, I'm going to be the president 24/7. Then he, in another one of his jokes, he really, you know, he's rich frat rats. They're really big on humor. And he said, I'm going to be 24/7, I'm going to be president. What did he say? 24 days a month, 7 months a year. And up to that time, he had taken more vacation just in those 7 or 8 months than any president had ever taken. So he's at his ranch, and he's shown this memo that says Bin Laden to strike in the United States. He says, and goes back to clearing brush. So he ignored that urgent warning, and he also ignored the urgent warning on Iraq. He was told by the top Iraq advisor, who said thousands of additional troops were desperately needed to quell the insurgency, and he said as late as November 2003, I don't want anyone in the cabinet to say it's an insurgency. I don't think we're there yet. This guy is wrong about absolutely everything. Oh, yeah. Shannon Caldwell reminds me that a final word about how you can do something. On Thursday, October 5th, that's this coming Thursday, there's an effort called World Can't Wait. The World Can't Wait. And you can go to worldcantwait.net. Don't put the apostrophe in. And it's an effort to stop the country in a general strike, essentially. Do we think that's going to happen? I don't. Do you, Jenna?
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, all of us, working folk, we are going to show up for work. We need to. We need the money. We can't not show up for work. We can't give up our jobs, because if we do, it's not like it was maybe 10 years ago where you don't show up for work at Starbucks and you go work at Caribou. There's a line out the door to Caribou. But they are calling for students to, as well, not show up for school. So no work, no school, no shopping. Come to mass demonstrations. They're all over the country. Our local demonstration in Detroit is at 12:30 at the Gluten Mall at Wayne State University.
Cullen.
Oh, thank you. And it's a march to the city county building and a 4:30 rally.
I like that, Gluten Mall.
You like that?
Gullen was an awful man. He was the president. I'm off on
well,
a
let's stick with
ahead.
That
go
then,
ahead.
Okay? We'll rename it. And
go
it
ahead.
Says, to bring signs and banners and guitars and drums and noisemakers. And it says here, and your anger, which I take issue with. You know, come on. If the point is peace, then maybe we can leave our anger behind and try to channel it into something a little bit higher. But it is a demonstration.
Right.
And the more the merrier, quite literally. However, how many times have we shown up to these demonstrations? These demonstrations, don't think work. But if everybody doesn't show up for school, I mean, at least then you have huge vacant buildings. The students are the ones who did it last time.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a matter of how many people show up. If the usual suspects, as we call them, 150 people show up, well, it'll just be a small gesture.
Sure.
If 15,000 people showed up, I mean, don't we have 15,000 people in Detroit?
We
that,
do.
That field? Don't we have 150,000 probably?
But look at the protests leading up to the war. I mean, we had, I don't know, how many people were down there right before the war? Do you remember the day of protests?
Well, yeah.
Okay. We probably,
February 15th.
Sure. So how many people do you figure were down there? I thought maybe 3,000 to 5,000 people.
Yeah. And in New York, where my wife and I were, pardon me, there were 1 million people in New York City. One of the coldest damn days I've ever been
freezing
out
here. Freezing here, too.
Yeah.
And we had the kids with us.
So I think it's wrongheaded to say, though, that this didn't do anything. Well, Bush was bound and determined, as even before he got in office, to attack Iraq and
absolutely.
Set up an imperial presence with military bases and gobbling up the oil and all that. But essentially what it did was to create the context for all the criticism that's come before that. Well, I'm wondering why my website is not coming up. I was trying to look at it. You know, Shannon, we're out of time. Shannon Caldwell, thanks for having joined me.
Thank you.
And a pleasure having you here. And thanks to all of you for listening and calling. And we'll see you outside on October 5th. Go to my website, even though it's not coming up. I don't know what's going on. Might even be just a server here at work. WERBE, PeterWerbe.com. Stay tuned for the interview.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF is
reserves the right to substitute any price for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrim.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. In the years I've been doing talk radio, sexuality and things having to do with sexuality are at once issues that people ignore in many ways and in other ways are consumed with them. There is a guest with me in the studio that can address many different facets of this. The book is called Unrepentant Whore, Collected Works of Scarlet Harlot. Carol Lee is the author. Carol Lee, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
I'm glad to be here, Peter. Thank you.
And here we have a rather risque photograph of you on the cover, although it looks you're in a bed of roses.
Mm-hmm.
But roses, of course, have thorns. Tell us about this very, very provocative title, Unrepentant Whore, Collected Works of Scarlet Harlot. Are you, you're Scarlet Harlot?
I am.
You can tell by your hair.
I'm Scarlet Harlot. And
Well, basically, unrepentant whore means I'm not going to say I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for being a sex worker, and I work with a lot of other sex worker activists. I've been part of the movement since the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
It was the days of Margot St. James and Coyote.
Out in San Francisco, where that's you're from. Right. And when you say you're not going to apologize for being a sex worker, more commonly that's called a prostitute.
Right. Right. People, I wonder if most people are familiar with the term sex worker.
I don't know.
I wonder. I don't know. I coined it in the late 70s,
really?
As a matter of fact. So it's in international use now. I think that there was a journal from the UN, and they said that in polite phraseology, you're supposed to use the term sex worker instead of prostitute.
Well, it also encompasses a larger body of people that are involved in this multi-billion-dollar industry, and it takes the moral judgment off it and simply places people in a particular industry.
Well, I mean, it's about work.
Yeah.
So it emphasizes the fact that this actually is work rather than some kind of deviance. But, previously, the word prostitute, for instance, is a euphemism. It means to put forth publicly. I mean, many of the words that we use for people who are providing sexual services are euphemisms, so this is very direct.
Well, there is, of course, an amazing amount of hypocrisy. Most people have extraordinarily negative, and I'm making an assumption, have anywhere from extraordinarily negative views of sex workers to, at best, thinking, well, it's nothing I'd like my daughter or son to be involved in. Yet, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people worldwide are involved in the sex industry, in pornography and what we were saying, prostitution, films. And it's amazing. I mean, I believe that pornography industry in the United States has greater revenues than all the major sports industries combined. So do you see that? And have you always found a large degree of
It's a huge labor force. And, I mean, one of the things that I've learned from being in this trade so long is about hypocrisy. You know, the fact that I may be with a client who acts like he adores me for the 45 minutes that I'm with him, and then later if he's a legislator, turn and vote against some sort of bill for my rights. So, I mean, I've seen a lot of that. And certainly he's not going to be able to admit that he sees a prostitute. So, I mean, I've seen all kinds of hypocrisy in the content of this work, and that's part of what you learn. That's kind of part of the wisdom that you actually get from this experience. Mm-hmm.
Now, Carol Lee, a lot of your work in the past few years, as you said, has been defending sex worker rights. What needs to be defended? A lot.
It's certainly a long story, but I know now sex workers are framing their rights in terms of human rights. For instance, in many cities, if on a condition of probation, when you're arrested, you're not allowed to return to the same neighborhood. It really abridges your right to travel. Personally, I feel that I have a right to determine who I have sex with and for what reasons. I mean, I feel like I have ultimate jurisdiction over my body. And for the state to come in and tell me who and what I have sex, I think that's very problematic. So I think that I regard as a fundamental right.
Well, that certainly is a holdover where, you know, we could argue about the propriety of one making that choice, but it really isn't anyone's choice other than the individual. And the state to intervene seems to be absolutely inappropriate, and throughout the years has been involved in nothing but corruption on the part of the people enforcing those laws, and as we said earlier, great hypocrisy. But the issues about prostitution or sex workers that have been in the news the most, it seems to me, over the last several years, have been about women who have been forced into prostitution. In fact, I'm looking at this article here from the Scotland Sunday. It's called Scotland on Sunday, and I know you've seen any number of them. Foreign prostitutes, 12 years old, for sale in Scotland. Is this a recent phenomenon, this child pornography, or not, I'm sorry, child prostitution?
Well, I mean, the whole trafficking framework is really a throwback. It was popularized at the turn of the century when they called it the white slave traffic. So that we're sort of revisiting it. And what I find most disturbing is that the trafficked woman, the person who is forced in some sort of slavery, becomes a symbol for all prostitution. And a lot of people who are promoting an abolition to prostitution and fierce repression talk often about trafficking and really talk about wanting to rescue these women and how abject the condition is for prostitutes. And it also obscures the details, the reality of the diversity of prostitutes' lives. So you may have a prostitute who is indeed in an abject situation, maybe because she's a slave, maybe because she has a drug problem or he has a drug problem. You may have another middle-class, working-class prostitute. You may have an immigrant or you may have someone working at a massage parlor. The population of prostitutes is diverse in terms of gender, class.
Well, that all said, there is a problem, obviously, in the way in the 19th century when children were forced into cotton mills to work and spend their life doing that rather than having the pursuits of children and or slaves in the South and other places. That seems to me to be whether it's 1% or 30% or whatever. I don't know if there's any way to see. It certainly is a horrifying sight. And I understand what you're saying about that, how that colors the rest of the activity. But I just wondering whether I heard you said the historic example, but I'm wondering whether you have any idea to gauge, is that a growing problem, a small problem?
Well, I think with increased migration issues, it's going to be an increasing problem. And I think that, for instance, the discourse about it started maybe in the early 90s, mid-90s, with the collapse of the Eastern Bloc, when there was a lot of traffic from and a lot of migration from Eastern Bloc countries to other European countries. And when there's more migration, when there are societies that are collapsed, and we certainly have that currently in the world, and I think, you know, due to capitalist forces and globalization forces, there will be more problematic prostitution. And problematic aspects of prostitution correlate directly to poverty. And, I mean, I would just say imperialism, to war. Most of the things that we find most disturbing and most problematic do correlate to the other problems on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Now, your book, Unrepentant Whore, Collected Works of Scarlet Harlot, was you, Carol Lee. I'm wondering, since you put forth a position that I support 100%, and that is a libertarian view that the political state has no right to govern adult women's activities, and particularly their sexual lives. Yet, is there a role for government and the political state and the police in policing these child the episodes that we were talking about, women that are forced as almost slaves to take part in prostitution?
Well, of course, I mean, I have a libertarian perspective when it comes to rights of control over my body, but I do think there's a role for the government in providing services, in finding other options. In terms of a criminalization, many of the people from a human rights perspective who've been working on the trafficking issue basically question the idea of how useful punitive approaches are compared to approaches that may relax some immigration policies and give rights to migrant workers, even rights to migrant sex workers. So basically, from my position, we're going at it the wrong way. We basically are creating conditions in which it's harder for people who are traveling to travel, and they are more at the mercy of these unscrupulous traffickers. So we can create even a more problematic black market.
Talk to me a little, if you will, about prostitution itself. Maybe you could begin by your personal experience, because generally, even, you know, getting through all the hypocrisy, most of us generally, and I say most of us generally, so anybody that's outside of this consensus can say I didn't include everyone, it's not usually the first pick of work. I usually think of it as a good-paying job for working-class women. So that, you know, beyond minimum wage work and what have you, so that if you can be a sex worker, rewards can often be quite beyond what a working woman could ordinarily earn.
Sounds right. I mean, there's so much stigma in the society, it's certainly not going to be one's first pick. In this society, in other societies, it may have another role. I mean, I remember hearing that in Russia, it was one of the most desired careers for young women. But, I mean, there's problematic aspects because, obviously, it's dangerous. And there's some kind of illusion in prostitution that you can make a lot of money and really succeed. And, you know, in truth, for many women who don't have the support and the background that other women have, they may have problems. And for young people on the streets who have no other options, I mean, it is dangerous. It is very difficult. And sometimes it seems like the strong and the lucky survive.
Mm-hmm.
For myself, I've wandered into it. I had finished with graduate school in creative writing, and I was a hippie. It was, you know, the old days, and mm-hmm. I was a feminist also. And I wanted to live on the edge, you know. I knew, like, and Ernest Hemingway, he went to war, and he wrote about it, right? And obviously, you know, this is like the front lines in the battle of the sexes, prostitution. So I thought, as a romantic writer, I was going to write about prostitution, explore it. So that was really, so my motivation was odd. Also, I was really in debt to Visa and MasterCard.
So was this a long occupation or something that was, you just did for what we say, you know, they say you experimented with marijuana in college, but the same thing. Was this something how essentially was your occupation for a number of years? Or
I started when I was about 27 in 1978. I mean, I still do occasionally see old clients. Now, for maybe 5 years, I've worked fairly regularly. I almost always worked only part time. So that might be 3 or 4 men a week.
Mm-hmm.
When I worked in Brother, I might see 3 or 4 men a day. I worked at my girlfriend's fetish business. I mean, this is not only a long-term career, but I've worked in very many different ways. Haven't really worked on the streets, but I've been seriously involved. I mean, at this point, you know, most of my friends are working as prostitutes, and I'm always involved in a community of strippers and prostitutes.
Why is there such a... Well, that made me think of another question. Let me ask this one first. Does this give you a negative impression of men in this being in this industry?
Before I became a prostitute, I was very angry at men because that was, you know, right after my feminist revelation. And I learned that, you know, men aren't really smarter than us. And I learned that society was brainwashing me, and it was men's fault, and it was the patriarchy. And I was really mad at my father for how he treated my mother. And I was mad at all my boyfriends. So I started doing prostitution, and, you know, it sort of necessitated, with my personality, it necessitated that I have some kind of sympathy. And there's something odd in prostitution you really never hear about. There's a ritual of flattery. Now, I'm really talking about sort of massage parlor or kind of more private work. I don't know about the streets, but the clients come to us and they say, oh, you're so beautiful. You're the very best. I just can't believe it. And then I say, oh, you're just so nice and wonderful. And you never hear about that. I'm sure you've never heard this, right? And nobody knows. So, contrary to my stereotypes, I was quite struck by the way I was treated by the clients, and that certainly made a huge difference in my life.
Yeah. Why do you think there is such an enormous audience for pornography? I mean, I guess the answer is probably obvious, but I'd like to hear what you have to say. Why is there such an enormous audience? Why is there such a large clientele for sex workers?
You know, there have not been enough anthropological studies about that. We're really squelched at the university level. If you have a graduate student, somebody working on their PhD, and they want to ask those questions, the professors say, why do you want to know? Watch out with your dissertation committee. As a matter, I mean, I have many theories. Is it sociological? I mean, is it cultural expression, or how biological is it? I mean, women primarily raise children.
Mm-hmm.
So one may say that for male psychosexuality, perhaps outreach to a variety of women may be some way in which their sexuality is expressed. I mean, I really don't know. I could have theories, but I have a very strong feeling that a lot more research needs to be done on this.
Well, I mean, I was thinking the simple answer was do not feel that they're not having as much sex in their life as they would like.
So. Well, of course. Yeah. I mean, that's the idea. What is that deprivation all about? When they're younger, they go through their horny period, right? So, and that's when women are just sort of coming into their sexuality. When I was young, we weren't necessarily ready to have sex all the time. I didn't develop my lust until in my 30s. So that disparity of coming at a time when you're formulating your sexuality and your personality contributes to this kind of dynamic of deprivation.
I was actually talking about this one time on a talk show I was doing, and some woman called in and she says, here's a hint to you married guys, take a shower before you come to bed. This will improve your sex life. The book is Unrepentant Whore, Collected Works of Scarlet Harlot, and you can go to lastgasp.com. the distributors in San Francisco, right?
Hey.
I know.
Amazon. It's on
Amazon. And Carol Lee is the author. Well, tell us a little about the work that you've done on behalf of defending sex worker rights. And that probably is not a phrase that is common to the audience. People, rights? What sort of rights would they have, and what sort of rights are being denied?
Of course, it's a long story. When I first started working at the massage parlor, I mean, I always realized that it was an invasion by the state to send the police into my bedroom to arrest me for having consensual sex. When I was working in a massage parlor, I was raped, and there were some men going around to all the different parlors and raping women.
Wow.
And I didn't call the police. I couldn't call the police. The other people at the parlor said, oh, the police will come and shut us down, and everybody will wind up on the street. And I mean, it was not reasonable to go to the police. So, I mean, it's very scary to be in this sexual context as your mode of work, and then to know that if you're raped, you have no recourse. And I think that we do have some kind of right to protect ourselves from being raped. I mean, raped. And this is really a human rights violation by the state to criminalize us so that we really have no recourse. And it's a very dangerous occupation.
Mm-hmm. And so tell me some of the work. And the name of your organization is?
I started with Coyote, Call Off Your Old Tired Ethics, in 1973. We still, we're kind of a mother organization. Organizations I work with now is BASWAN, Bay Area Sex Worker Advocacy Network, and it's baswan.org on the internet, so I have extensive information about sex worker rights around the world. Swap-USA.org is also a new organization that's really headed this campaign to decriminalize. So basically what we're looking for are regulations that recognize us as labor, allow us to unionize, we can work in businesses, we can work independently, we can work in small collectives, and we wouldn't be arrested. So prostitution gets taken out of the category of criminalization. It's regulated by their business codes.
Tell us a little about a history of the organizing of prostitutes. I think I remember between 1936 and 1939 in Spain that the prostitutes there, I know about this one, okay, that they actually organized, but into unions and demanded recognition. And the women's group, Mujeres Libres, free women, were,
I never heard this. I really have to look this up.
Okay.
No, it's not. I have no idea.
Okay. But give us just maybe contemporary examples of, because we hear in different cities there's red light districts and there's some of it has been decriminalized. What's the experience across the Western world these days?
You know, I also remember some 18th century or 19th century kind of demonstrations in the context of churches where there would be some kind of red light, some kind of abatement act for brothels, and the prostitutes, I remember, came to church one day, and they said, you know, we're part of the community, and you're hypocritical to get rid of us because all of you use our services. So, I mean, I look through history, and I see there have been all kinds of little demonstrations like that, pointing out the hypocrisy. But the modern sex worker rights union started in Europe and in this country in the early 70s. In France, there was a church occupation in the early 70s. And basically because of increased arrests, there, even in Europe when there is no laws explicitly against prostitution, police will use loitering laws to arrest prostitutes. Prostitution criminalization is very old. They were usually categorized with beggars and jugglers.
Maybe you could combine those occupations. That would be pretty pretty entertaining. You know, one of the things, tyranny on victim crimes, and the other one is the legalization of drugs. And when I advocate that, people will say, everybody would be using drugs, you know, that addiction would skyrocket and all of that. If there was a decriminalization of sex work, any vision of how things would be different? Do you think that there would be a real change?
Decriminalization is just the first step.
Mm-hmm.
As I explained before, you know, the problems in prostitution really relate to poverty. So if you decriminalize, and, you know, what I see all around the world when they do change the laws, then they go after another population of prostitutes who are in a more marginalized situation. When they decriminalized or legalized brothels in the Netherlands, and formerly they had been tolerated, so they made them all legal because they didn't want too many migrants around. And then now they deport the migrant workers, and there's more police involved. So, I mean, it's very difficult to figure out how to regulate. So prostitutes' rights advocates will also regulate into make recommendations in terms of more rights for migrants. And more rights for people who are using substances is really along those lines. Our movement is a bit divided about that to some extent, but those of us who are kind of in the progressive end of the movement do also talk about the right of them to right of people to use drugs and not to be arrested for it. And, you know, much of the criminalization of women, and we see a lot of prostitutes in prisons, but really because of drug-related crimes. So these women who are doing drugs, and men too, who are doing drugs and using prostitution to pay for the drugs, I mean, that happens because of the criminalization of the drugs. So while we're trying to address prostitution issues and helping people who are in these poorest circumstances, issues about drugs really goes hand in hand.
Well, if we didn't victimize people within victimless crimes, if we had an equitable distribution of wealth in this society that didn't make people poor, there could turn out to be a significantly fewer number of sex workers, right?
Significantly, well, theoretically. I mean, of course, it's very utopian. In general, I mean, the problems of prostitution are always going to be relating to poverty. And I mean, if in this country there are more lenient laws and there's more support, then what about in the next country? And when they send their migrant, and when the migrants come over, and that's the problem they find internationally. So it is a very long term, and it is about human rights, and it's really about human rights for the whole planet.
Mm-hmm. Is there any political will in any of the legislatures, from Congress down to the state and city levels, that support the kind of vision that you put forth? And the reason that I ask that, it seems so improbable that any politician would dare to get on board with this.
Well, that's true in this country to some extent, but in New Zealand in 2003 just decriminalized prostitution. Australia has some decriminalization models. Many countries in Europe are going more towards models. For instance, in England, they made it legal to work for two or three women can work alone in an apartment. And so the laws are becoming more lax, and I do hope that our country isn't going to necessarily be more repressive. The discourse of trafficking may really impel options for decriminalization or some kind of law reform. If people feel that if there's a problem, then if they make prostitution more legal, they can oversee the business. There can be more regulation. So that may give some sort of impetus towards changing the laws. I mean, we advocate, we wait, but we have a lot of allies. Well, internationally, a lot of allies in labor. In this country, not so much. The human rights movement in Europe and in Asia as well is very sympathetic. But in this country, it's you know, the Democrats and the Republicans get together, and that's how they get together, by passing bad laws about prostitution and drugs.
Yeah. We only have actually about 30 seconds left. People are listening to this on a Sunday, and probably some of them are saying, this woman's a sinner. Do you have anything that is arable to say to them?
Then people say, oh, I don't know, I'm an unrepentant whore, is that arable? Well, I think really I'm mostly talking about a compassionate approach. And although prostitution, one realizes, is not necessarily the best choice and may not be the best choice in your life, this is a survival strategy. And a survival strategy for someone who may be in a more difficult situation than you. So I ask people to look at this compassionately. And arrest is traumatizing.
The book is Unrepentant Whore, Collected Works of Scarlet Harlot. Carol Lee has been my guest. It's available from Amazon. It's available at LASP.com. And real quickly, we can the websites again.
Okay, well, they can go to unrepentanthwhore.com if they could spell it. They can go to bayswan.org, BAYSWAN.org.
Well, Carol Lee, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Peter.
Got a buck, get a song.
Can I get a holla, holla?
Log on to WRIF.com and check out the digital music store. Any riff song is available for just 99 cents online. Browse by artist, title, or riff playlist. Easy and cheap. The Riff Digital Music Store at WRIF.com. Everything.
Get into it.
That rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
just where you lay down. Try the waters till the dead skin of their dead. What did you expect to find? Was it something you left behind? Don't you remember anything I said when I said, jump away, leave me to myself, jump away.
On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Morning. Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you, as always. And it's been an increasing pleasure over the last few weeks. I'm sure you've probably taken note of this if you've been a regular listener to the broadcast, that I've been bringing friends to the microphone. It's a pleasure to have people that you know and to allow them to express themselves about the literature that they've written. Joining me today is an old friend, Pun Plamondon. You may remember that name if you remember back in the day. Pun Plamondon was in the White Panther Party. His life intersected with the anti-war culture of the 1960s, with the MC5, Detroit's little rock band. And through a series of circumstances that we'll get into, he wound up on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. The name of his book is, and it's a curious one, but it's what I think is provocative. The whole journey provocative, beginning from the title and the story itself, Lost from the Ottawa, The Story of the Journey Back, a memoir by Pun Plamondon. Pun, a pleasure seeing you once again.
Thank you, Peter. I'm sure you that the pleasure is mine.
Yeah. Hey, this book, talking before the broadcast, the whole story, essentially your memoir up from the literally from the moment you were born up till just the last year or two, is really too much to tell in the 25 minutes we have. But just maybe explain the title, Lost from the Ottawa, to begin with, and then we'll get into the story of the journey back as well. So give us kind of an impression of what the book is all about.
Well, my biological parents were mixed-blood Native Americans, and I was removed from their custody and put up for adoption in 1945. I was adopted by the Plamondons, which was a Catholic, white, hardworking family up in Traverse City. And so that's where the concept of Ottawa, at an early age, at 18 months, I was removed from the custody of my parents, biological parents, put up for adoption. And after being adopted, I didn't really fit in with the Plamondon family. I didn't fit in with school. I didn't fit in hardly anywhere.
Yeah,
and so that's the loss from the Ottawa part of it.
And you were a kid in trouble a lot.
Oh yeah, very much. Yeah. I was in reform school when I was from 14 to 15 years old.
Now, when I go up to the Traverse City area, and you go north in Traverse City, is that what Highway 7? Is that what it is? Or going up to Northport?
I believe that.
There, I always see this mailbox. It says Plamondon.
Oh, there's a lot of Plamondons up there.
Are there?
Plamondon shoes and several Dr. Plamondons. Plamondon settled in Lake Leelanau, Michigan. In fact, early records show that the first name of Lake Leelanau was Plamondonville. They were immigrants from Canada pretty much settled that area. So there's a lot of them up there.
Now, you had a wild youth that could have been a story of many teens in the late 50s and early 60s, car trips all over the United States, brushes with the law, drug and alcohol and sexual adventures, all that are chronicled and lost from the Ottawa. But when I first met you, you were an anti-war activist, and actually, unless it's something that shouldn't be told, I don't even remember the exact circumstances of our meeting. Of course, I was working with the so-called underground newspaper, the Fifth Estate, then, bring us into the 60s. I mean, when you took that sort of personalized individual rebellion and transformed it into a rebellion against the society of the 1950s and 1960s.
Well, I came to Detroit in May of 1967, but prior to that, I had been working as a union organizer, organizing migrant farm workers. And so I had the beginnings of a political consciousness. The war was becoming more visible, and the effects of the war, of course, the anti-war movement was getting started and gaining momentum. So when I came to Detroit, one of the things that impressed me was that people like yourself and John Sinclair were putting out their own newspapers. I was coming from a small town, Traverse City background, and it never occurred to myself or my friends that young people could take matters, as it were, into their own hands and put out their own newspaper and put out their own magazines and put out their own plays. And I thought you had to have a degree or somebody's permission. And here were, again, people like yourself and Sinclair and then others all around the country. The entire underground press syndicate and the underground press movement was just eye-opening and very exciting for someone like myself and for millions of other young people who were shown that doors could open and you could open them yourself. You didn't have to wait. You could do it now.
Well, it's interesting, too, that phrase, counterculture. I think people today, particularly younger people, may think, you say counterculture, and they think of somebody with a guy with long hair and a beard. But it was authentically, if you use the word precisely, it was a counterculture, and it was full. It had its as you said, its own press, movies, theater, what so many rebellious movements did. So you came to Detroit, your eyes were open, and you hooked up with John Sinclair, who was associated first with the Artist Workshop, which had begun in 1964. Actually, we interviewed John and other people from the group who they had just celebrated the 40th anniversary of the founding of it. Mm-hmm. John also worked closely with the MC5, Detroit Seminole Rock Band, and you got caught up with them as well.
Well, I Sinclair at the time, and Grimshaw and Emil Basila and of course, Lenny Sinclair and several others were living above the offices of the Fifth Estate, as you well remember. And I just thought that was about the coolest place to live in the entire world.
It was.
To have a underground paper with their offices below you and then the mobilization to end the war in Vietnam on the very corner. And so when I finagled my way into that little commune, I thought I was in the center of the universe and felt I was right there where the action was. And
for that counterculture and for what in many ways typified that era, you were.
Yeah. The best thinking or some of the best thinking and organizers and activists of that era were, you know, in those offices and frequenting those offices and coming around and visiting and such.
You just mentioned in passing one of the people that was there was Grimshaw, and of course you referred to the genius poster artist Gary Grimshaw, who did the cover to your memoir Lost from the Ottawa, the story of the journey back by Pun Plamondon, my guest. And Gary, most known for his incredible Grand Ballroom posters. And for those of you maybe who aren't aware of the Grandy Ballroom, doesn't everybody Isn't everybody that knows a little about music history have to know about the
and
Grand
they
Ebola?
Must, yeah.
Just let's see. Run out some bands that you remember that you saw live.
Oh, Cream, Jimi Hendrix, MC5,
Big Brother in the Holding, Janis Joplin, Big Brother in the Holding.
Yeah.
Did the Who play there? Did you?
I wouldn't doubt it. Yeah. I know the Who played at Cobo because the MC5 opened for them.
Yeah.
At Cobo.
Yeah. So life was wonderful. Was it wonderful for you?
Oh, that was the most exciting time of my life. And I said in the book several times that I thank the Creator that I could remember these things. Like the first demonstration I went to in New York, April 15th, and marched with 400,000 people to end the war. I mean, that many people all moving in one direction with the concept of peace in their heart was just a moving, emotional mm-hmm. thing. And to go through the riots in Detroit and see the camaraderie among the poor people, it was never a race, and don't ever let them say that it was a race mm-hmm. riot. It was poor people striking out against that exploitation. And we got to remember, it was so recent, yet so far away in our memory, that the Detroit Police Department was all white and that there was this incredible drain on the black community with absentee landlords taking the profits from the black community and taking them to the suburbs. And that's been going on for generations. And the stories about how second-class produce, how once the produce gets too old in the suburban stores, they bring it down and sell it in the ghetto stores.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all true stories. And so to be part of that rebellion against that exploitation and oppression was a spiritual moment for me, just to see it happen.
Well, the one chapter I read of your book, Pun, Lost from the Ottawa, was when, right at the time of the riot, maybe you could relate the story, when you and Emil Bacilla were taking a load of, what did you have, baseball?
Brooms.
Brooms. Yeah, tell this story.
Well, there used to be the Detroit Free Press used to run a column called Action Line, I think. And if you had a problem with a institution or an organization or a corporation and you were running into red tape, or if you had some good community-based thing that you wanted to do, this Action Line column would help you cut through the red tape and do it. So I contacted, this was after the Belle Isle Love-In, and I decided and talked to Sinclair and a few others about it that we should do a neighborhood sweep-in, a clean-in, clean up the neighborhood.
And this is in 1967 now.
And the idea, our neighborhood down by Wayne State was made up primarily of poor whites and blacks and Appalachian poor folks and Chicanos. So it was a real multicultural neighborhood. And I felt that by cleaning up the neighborhood together, we could kind of get to know each other and build community. And so Action Line printed my letter, and they made connections whereby the city of Detroit, the fire department, would hook up some hoses to a fire hydrant, and we could literally wash the streets, and this Department of Sanitation would send two trucks, and they'd park them at various corners in the neighborhood for people to throw their stuff away. And Acme Broom and Brush down on the east side donated 100 brooms, some big old push brooms and regular, like, house brooms. Well, they came in long boxes, cardboard boxes. Well, the riots started, and we never got to do our sweep-in. You told me about it on the morning. You asked me if I heard about what had been going on over at 12th and Claremont. And so me and Amo drive over there in his stereotypical hippie van.
Towards the scene of the riot.
Yeah, 12th and Claremont. And when we get there, they had a gauntlet of police cars and cops that you had to drive down through, and some cops saw all those boxes in the back, and they were just as long as rifles would be, and so they pulled over and tore these brooms out of the truck, threw them all around the street, and then, believe it or not, you could hear some shooting from up the block, and some wine bottles started breaking, and the cops just left us there with these brooms, which they thought were guns, and we cleaned up a few and sped away.
My guest on the Peter Werby Show, Pun Plamondon, his memoir is Lost from the Ottawa, The Story of the Journey Back. And Pun will be reading from his book and doing book signings March 4th, and it's Friday, March 4th, 7 to 9 p.m. at Bookbeat, a fine store in the Lincoln Shopping Center, 10.5 Mile and Greenfield in Oak Park. Now, I asked you just a little while ago how you were relating to these events. And you said these were incredible times, and they were. You remember from the Dickens things, the Dickens book, Tale of Two Cities, was the best of times and was the worst times, because one of the themes through laws from the Ottawa, of course, is your drug and alcohol abuse, and in fact, severe addiction.
Right.
So, and that's what I meant as well. I mean, so you were, here you were with music from the MC5 and the Who, these anti-war demonstrations, this cultural explosion, riots in the city. And when did this?
Well, from probably the first year, maybe 2 years, when I came to Detroit, I actually quit drinking. I started doing other drugs, of course, LSD, and smoking a lot of reefer and doing some speed from time to time, but that wasn't a common habit. But the people that I was hanging out with, they didn't seem to drink and abuse alcohol like my old crew in Traverse City. I mean, I hung out with some real redneck beer-drinking brawlers up north. And these people that I was hanging out now around the Detroit Artists Workshop and Translove Energies and the Fifth Estate and other places, they didn't seem to have that same addiction and that same attraction to rowdiness and alcohol.
We drank hardly nothing,
yeah.
As a matter of fact, yeah.
Yeah. We did other things, though, to stimulate our mental capacities.
I did not inhale, though.
No, right. That would be wrong.
Okay. Go ahead. Go ahead.
So anyway, it wasn't really until I got out of prison behind the CIA bombing trial and the wiretapping and such.
People go, what's this about? But okay, we'll get back to that. Go ahead.
That I really started abusing alcohol again. That was my drug of choice. And that had tremendous ramifications for the White Panther at that time, called the Rainbow People's Party, because I believe I played my role in the collapse, and part of that role was functioning at less than my highest ability and being drunk most of the time, quite frankly.
Well, in your memoir, Lost from the Ottawa, I mean, the description of the effect of alcohol on you is absolutely staggering. I had no idea that it had done that to you. I mean, the depths, particularly towards the last quarter of the book, after like 1975, I believe. But at some point, I want to get back to the CIA case, because everybody's going, wait a minute, what's the CIA bombing? What's that all about? But you became a roadie with Bob Seger.
Yeah, right? Well, that was long after I got out of prison.
Yeah.
And the CIA deal.
Yeah.
Let's go back to that CIA deal.
Okay, let's do that one. In fact, I want to get you to read a little from the book as well, because this is an incredible court case that had ramifications for Watergate and for Richard Nixon and Nixon's eventual resignation. My guest is Pan Plamondon. He's written a memoir, Lost from the Ottawa, The Story of the Journey Back, and it's self-published. And we'll tell you in a little while where you can get it. It's 415 pages, and I just sped through it. Just absolutely incredible. I'm treading a little water here while Pun is finding the section that we're going to talk about. Anyways, there was we heard that there was a CIA office bombed in Ann Arbor. Was it 1970?
It was 1968, October.
Okay.
Someone placed a dynamite bomb at a secret CIA office in Ann Arbor, and they were recruiting graduate students and professors, as he was. But nonetheless, it was supposed to have been a secret office. Someone found out where it was and pretty much blew it to hell. A year after the bombing, I was charged with doing the bombing and conspiring with Sinclair and Jack Forrest to commit the bombing.
I'm sure my audience would like me to ask you, did you do it?
Well, we're like many governments. My lawyer, 35 years ago, Buck Davis,
right,
and he says, don't say anything about it. And so he's never rescinded that order, and so I'm under strict orders from Buck Davis. I don't admit or deny it.
Okay.
I mean, I have a vested interest one way or another. If I said I did it, I may have a vested interest, or if I say I didn't do it. And I tried to leave it ambiguous in the book as to whether or not I did it, because if I can play that little outlaw card, I will. And I figure it's not my responsibility socially or civically to do the work the FBI and the Justice Department is supposed to do.
Okay. We'll leave that part at that.
So anyway, a year after the bombing, I was charged. Now, at that time, Sinclair was in prison doing his famous 9.5 to 10 year sentence for possession of 2 marijuana cigarettes, and the entire effort of the White Panther, or at that time Rainbow People's Party, was directed toward changing the Michigan marijuana laws, getting Sinclair and the other prisoners who were doing similar sentences released. We heard about it on the radio, WABX, as a matter of fact.
The bombing, yeah.
That I had been indicted for this. And it, with Sinclair in prison and our other economic situations about to collapse, I decided quite quickly that I should not be captured, that I should go underground until we can try to get ourselves organized to attack this fabricated case. The point of the case is not whether or not I did the bombing. The point of the case for me was that I knew the so-called evidence they were using against me was fabricated. I never talked to this guy, David Vallers.
He was the government informant.
He was the informant, and they call it the unindicted co-conspirator. I never talked to him about dynamite. I never talked to him about blowing up any buildings. I never talked to him. He supposedly had called me and complimented me on my choice of targets. I never had that phone call. So I knew, whether or not I blew up the building, I knew that the case they were bringing against me was fabricated, and that was reason enough for me to go underground. I went underground, stayed underground for a year, got a phony passport from Canada through those Quebecois, that liberation, French-speaking liberators up in Quebec, and traveled to Europe and ultimately to Algiers, where I was going to apply for political asylum. And I was staying with Eldridge Cleaver in a small American exile community.
Who was Black Panther, who was on the lam. Yeah.
Well.
And you were on the FBI's 10 most wanted list.
Right. While I was here, of course, we had somewhat of a plan about my going underground, how we would communicate and such. For instance, about 3 blocks from our house in Ann Arbor is a famous dormitory at the U of M called East Quad. And at that time, East Quad had a whole bank of payphones, the old-fashioned kind of payphones that Superman used to change his clothes
right.
in, you know.
Yeah.
And so we had it on Thursday night at 7 o'clock, every Thursday at 7 o'clock, someone would be at this particular payphone and they'd be waiting for a call from me. So I could call and let people know I was safe or whatever.
Well, Punpo London, could you read a little bit from Lost from the Ottawa?
For the, well, maybe that's thought I would, yes.
And
one of the things that's interesting about our Supreme Court case is its connection to the Watergate break-in. Let me just read a little bit here. Though I didn't know it at the time, this Supreme Court decision and the Watergate break-in were connected. Years later, it was explained to me. The justice decided the Supreme Court wiretap issue on Friday, the 16th of June. According to court rules, the decision was to be kept secret until it was released by the court, in this case, the following Monday. However, someone at the High Court, I believe Rehnquist or his clerk, notified the White House and informed them the wiretap issue had been lost. This meant that any wiretaps installed by the executive branch or its agents or Nixon's reelection committee would be illegal on Monday the 19th when the ruling was made public. The Watergate burglars were sent into the Democratic National Headquarters to retrieve the electronic listening devices on Saturday the 18th of June. Before the Monday release of the decision made warrantless wiretaps unconstitutional. The rest, as they say, sucks.
Wow. Plummeted from his memoir. You know, we've got about 2.5 minutes left. This is, we said this was going to fly through. Lost from the Ottawa, the story of the journey back. Give us just a brief idea how you were in the depth of alcoholism to an extent that I was literally shocked upon reading your memoir. And something life-altering occurred.
Well, through a set of circumstances that are almost mystical, I happened upon a Ottawa elder and a holy man. And I told him that I had some court papers that showed that I was part Ottawa and that my biological parents were both Native Americans. I have been trying for about a year to get sober, and I'd quit for 2 weeks or a month, and then I'd drink again and go just nuts when I drank, had blackouts all the time. And my close friends kept telling me that I needed some sort of a spiritual center in my life. I needed to believe in something other than myself. And this Ottawa holy man explained to me that we Ottawa often believe that what we commonly call God is really a mystery, and that I should believe that there is a great mystery in this universe, and that I'm part of that great mystery. And somehow those words and that concept opened up a spiritual part of me that I had just didn't know existed, and I didn't even know I was looking for it. And so that's the story of the journey back. I finally come back to the Ottawa, am recognized by my tribe, and become a tribal council member and a respected and valuable member of my tribe and the Native community of Michigan.
Well, it's an absolute incredible story. You can hear more, and of course this is a book, but you can hear more from Pun Plamondon Friday, March 4th, at Bookbeat, 7 to 9 p.m., Lincoln Shopping Center in Oak Park, 10 and a half mile, and Greenfield. And the book will be available for sale and signing. But what about my listeners that are anxious to get it and won't be able to? You know, people listen all over the country and all over the world.
They can get it directly from my publisher at www.trafford.com, or they can get it at barnesandnoble.com, and very shortly it'll be on amazon.com and Powell's and all the rest of the electronic booksellers.
And I will have a link on my website, Peter Werby. Pun Plamondon, thanks so much for being with me.
Hey, thank you, Peter. It's really a joy.
This is WRIF.com.
Show me where to look, tell me. City.
This is
Jay Hudson.
Jay Hudson.
There is none higher.
I'm goddamn W.R.I.F. with the
Jay Hudson.
Yow!
Straight out of Detroit, baby.
Hell yeah, man.
Hey!
Score, score, score!
Oh, that sounds so sweet.
Jay Hudson, I love you.
Hey, you think KFC's still open?
I'm cut! Consider me f***ing
Jay Hudson.
This is my f***ing chocolate bakery. You better...
No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now. No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now.